And we started up again, and you're tuning back into part three of what is Hacker Public Radio's New Year show. And that's it, carry on.
The main problem with us wishing people in North Korea a Happy New Year is that they won't be able to hear us.
And that they, I hope they release the source code to their Linux distribution. They're currently violating GPL.
You mean red flag? Is that what you're talking about?
I think it's red something.
I thought the red flag was the Chinese version.
Red Star
OS. Yeah, that's
OS.
The Chinese.
Oh, right. That's, yeah.
Which sounds like a great arcade game, doesn't it? Red Star OS.
I think the Red Star Army was the bad guys in that that Game Boy game. I forget what it was called now, though.
I've got actually Red Flag on an actual tiny little Atom that I bought just to hack on everything else put on. For Linux, that's the most commercial version of Linux that I've ever seen, because I think you have to pay to get to the repositories.
Red Flag or Red Star?
I mean, this mean that the repos for the version that's on there are most deprecated, because you go to update, you can't do anything, and if you hit their website, you can't get any help on anything unless you subscribe.
I think Red Flag was a Red Hat clone for China.
Yeah, that so it could correct. Just be like the RHN network or something that you need to either uninstall or, yeah, pay to play.
You can just see Bradley Coombe being overjoyed at being given North Korea as this year's assignment. Right, North Korea's GPL violations, that's your target.
They just need to get Claw 2 to switch it over, the Red Hat install over to CentOS.
Yeah.
So, Jonathan, Pipe Man had a follow-up question for you, and he was, and actually I had a question relating to his, but he wants to know if you prefer an accessible GUI environment to a command line only environment, or would you rather have just command line only, but there aren't all the applications you need?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've tried to do strictly command line stuff, but like with e-links or like links and stuff, the problem with that is if there's like logins on websites that are like JavaScript and stuff, and none of that works with like e-links or links. So that's one problem. I could get by with like, you know, a mail client like Alpine or Mutt or whatever. I could use that. Pigeon has a command line version called Finch, so everything in Pigeon works in Finch from the command line. So I could probably do most things from the terminal, but, you know, unfortunately there are some applications that are strictly, like, GUI-based, so kind of stuck using the GUI. I personally wouldn't care. I would use whatever I could get work done the fastest on. So if I could get my workflow to strictly command line stuff and not have to do GUI stuff, I would totally do it.
But there does seem to be potential there. I mean, if you look at the way we're now putting virtual machines as heads for the cloud, is there potential there to make accessible tech workspaces as cloud environments?
Yeah, I would guess there would be at some point. You could essentially access a headless environment, like you were saying. I could see a potential in that.
I shall make a point of bringing that up. When I get my feet under the table at the company, I'll make a mention of that to join, because it seems to be latitude there, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Is there a distro or a Sonar distro that you can just pop a CD into a headless machine and plug in a keyboard and a set of headphones and go to work?
Yes, like, I believe the Ubuntu 12.04 and 12.10. For a while they were requiring that a monitor was plugged in. Like if you put the disk in, it wouldn't boot up. But I think as of 12.04 and 12.10, you can put a disk in. It'll boot off the disk even if there isn't a monitor plugged in, and you know you'll hear Orca talking and you can just walk right through it.
I think that you might have better success with Puppy, actually, because Puppy is compatible with all the Ubuntu repositories, but it's designed to work off a USB disk, so that might be an easier route.
Yeah, that's true, too. You could try that.
And we're talking about like a server here, not a desktop computer, is what I was asking about. But
I guess there would be a way I could implement a server kind of distribution where, because I know the Debian installer is really accessible, so I'd probably have to figure out a way how to like tie in the Debian installer. I mean, if I was going to do that, I guess I would just build a total Debian like server-based distro with the talking installer. It'd be a lot easier than to try and take a Debian installer and tie it into...
Why does it matter? I don't understand the question. Like, if you can get something installed, then you can turn it into a server. I mean, who cares if it's got LXDE running in the background? Is that taking that many resources?
Yeah, probably not. I think LXDE takes up like 35 megs or something.
No, I didn't mean to give you a task, Jonathan. I was just wondering if it existed.
Not to my knowledge. I guess the best bet would be to take a, as of the Debian Wheezy net installs, if you did that, there's an accessible installer in that. So you could just get the net install of Wheezy and build up your own server right from that if you want to go about it that way.
Okay. Yeah, no, I thought X was fairly heavy, though. The Klaatu was why I was asking.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes, I don't know. You know, For a while, I sort of thought the same thing, and then I was talking to Red Hat back when we had a Red Hat license or whatever, and it seemed like all the support people kind of assumed that you were running X. You know, like every call I would make, they'd be like, go to this window or something, and I was like, don't exactly have that. So, I don't know, it kind of surprised me, and ever since then, I've kind of, on a lot of the, like, the desktop machines that are acting as servers, I go ahead and install X just so it's there, and it doesn't seem to bother me.
So, Klaatu, when you called in, did they refer to you as Mr. Klaatu?
No, they didn't.
Mr. Two.
Yeah, just Mr. Two.
Did you say Shibboleth? Did you say Shibboleth and get transferred to someone with a minimum knowledge of two programming languages?
Yeah, I've had issues with that.
What about haptic feedback? Is that going to be useful to you at all?
Yeah, it's actually pretty useful on like an Android phone where, like, you know, you're dragging your finger across the screen and it lets you know, like, hey, you're kind of in, like, it vibrates when it lets you know you're kind of in a different region. So it'll read to you what you're scrolling across as your finger's going across the screen, but also will give you a little feedback of the phone vibrating or whatever, letting you know, hey, this is a new region of the phone that you're on now.
Maybe I just heard it wrong. Did you just say it lets you know?
Exactly.
That's beautiful. Yeah, we had a show, I think it was the accessibility show, right, where someone came on and she said her brother was deaf and he couldn't feel his phone buzzing anymore because of the stupid little haptic vibrators instead of the actual spinning motor with a weight on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that could be a nice hacking project for a Raspberry Pi if you could get some libraries for haptic feedback into Pi as well.
Klaatu, you have like a mobile like Raspberry Pi, don't you?
No, I'm working my way there. I'm looking at all my options, but I've not actually implemented that yet. But that's not a project I've forgotten about.
He's something we were talking about a year ago, the feedback motors.
I don't know, 5150. What about them?
Oh, on the New Year's podcast a year ago, wasn't this something that came up? The how to create feedback motors, what we could use. You know, could you take one of the little motors out of the vibrating razors or something like that to build one?
I don't know what we talked about last year. I was drinking.
Yeah, same here. I'm amazed that you can remember.
Klaatu, when was it that you were working on Red Hat stuff? Because I've talked to Red Hat support recently, and they didn't expect that I was running X on any of the servers I was working on.
It was almost exactly a year ago, and also I only ever dealt with like the first tier support. So I don't know if you... We had a very basic academic license, so we got... I feel like we got people... And I've said this before, it felt like I was talking to people. It felt like I was talking to myself. Like, they knew exactly as much as I did. It was really kind of interesting and kind of cheered me up because I was like, I could be working at Red Hat. I know that much about Linux at this point.
Nice. So were they just assuming that you had a rack of servers with a KVM switch on it, or what?
I don't know. I didn't exactly ask what they imagined I was doing, but that's kind of how it felt, yeah.
That's weird because I've run into... managing servers remotely, just like in systems engineering, where I would just SSH into it and work on it that way. And I figured that that was the normal way that most people did it.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought. You know, I mean, that's how I manage my servers, and that's kind of the little bit of training on servers that I, the formal training that I've had, that was the assumption there as well. So I was really surprised when they kept, like, literally two or three phone calls that I made, that it was very consistent. They would always refer to, you know, where to go in the GNOME desktop to find that system setting or the sysconfig, you know, thing. And I was like, well, I don't have X, but I'll bring that up, you know, in curses or whatever. So yeah, I was a little bit surprised by it myself.
Well, I think that the thing there is that the Red Hat, when they actually offer their training, actually shows you how to do everything under the GNOME desktop in X, whereas those of us who've actually been admining for a while actually always do everything from the command line and through a shell. And so, you know, it's really, depending on what level of support you get, it's going to depend on what they think your level of knowledge is, and that's going to basically dictate how they actually handle your stuff. You know, especially if you have a support contract that you actually have an account representative and stuff like that, they're not going to assume that you're running an X server on your server.
Yeah, and like I know that I was at the bottom rung for support for sure. Like I got that. I mean, they were great. I would have renewed the license if it had been up to me, because they always had like, they would always have that one idea that I hadn't had yet, or they would know about one tool that I didn't know about, you know. So it was definitely worth it, and it was great. I really enjoyed it, but I definitely felt like I was getting people who were just barely ahead of me in their knowledge.
One thing to do with Red Hat, this is a little hint for anybody who has like a basic contract or anything. If you run a SOS report and attach that to any ticket that you open with them for their support, that will actually get you a little bit further with them, because as soon as that's there, they're going to try to analyze that, and that might help you get past this, oh, do you have X installed type thing.
Cool.
Yeah, this was me interfacing with Red Hat as an engineer for a corporation, so I'm guessing that this wasn't level one support or lower level, whichever way you want to go on the support chain.
Yeah, we had two licenses. One was the really, really super basic one. That was for one building. And then in the other building, I had it licensed just the academic one, which was like, I think, self-support only. So you could sign into the knowledge base. I don't think I could make calls. So I got it. Those were the two levels I was at. I never really got elevated anything beyond that. And that's fine with me, because if I'd had to go higher than that, then that meant my problem was very serious. It was always just silly stuff that I'd overlooked.
You didn't just every time you talked to them be like, "So you're still using RPM, huh?" It wasn't just that every time.
Did I troll them? No, I did not. I chose not to do that.
Not so much trolling; it's more of a griefing thing, you know.
You know, but you guys, you people have RPM.
Ouch.
You have RPM issues that I've never had. I mean, I don't have that experience. I don't have that negative that negative association with RPM. I just hasn't happened to me.
I've run into problems in the past, and I just recently, after hearing your podcast about Slackware, I give it a try, and it's been really pleasant. Especially knowing about all those Slack builds, and once you get everything up and running, it's pretty good. I like the fact that it has like a base install of all the packages you need to basically get the work done from the beginning. So getting the Slack builds up and running doesn't require you to go download and install all the other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and that solves your RPM issue too. But yeah, I mean, I think with Slack builds on and Slackware being such a robust installation in the first place, you're pretty set up pretty quickly from the get go. I like their model a lot.
Slackware, I wouldn't be here even, because that was the very first distro I ever found like 12 years ago.
I started out on SUS, but it ended up being so unstable. Then I found Slackware, and it just booted up right to the shell, and I was sort of forced to learn how to do the command line, how to compile packages, and do most of the stuff from the command line. and even configure X and all that. Back then, there was problems with audio, so I had to try to configure ALSA the right way, and only would able to have one audio stream working at the same time. So it was get your hands dirty doing all this stuff, but you learned a lot.
I came through an original route. I came through the Linspire route. That's not well being Linspire. Path, is it?
No, not really.
Oh yeah, Zandros or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you liked it enough to stick with Linux, I guess. How'd you like it, like in general?
They had some neat ideas. Like they their repositories were all set up through a web interface long before that was popular. So they got into the App Store idea, which made making it usable very easy. And that was before Ubuntu went quite so mainstream, and that's where I went to after Linspire started collapsing.
Yeah, see, now this is an interesting question that you bring up, because I think that idea is great, having the repository interface be, like, I don't know, web-based or at least look web-based, like, you know, pretty with big buttons and icons and text that you can read. I have yet to find a repository interface that I think is worth any good. You know, I mean, I would much rather deal with repositories on the command line than ever deal with any of the GUI ones that I've seen so far. Is it just me, or am I just not looking in the right place, or how do people feel about that?
What about Synaptic?
I was going to say Synaptic.
Oh my gosh, I hate that. I hate Synaptic.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Unless maybe I haven't used it lately, but I mean, my only memory of it is that it would have, you know, you would search for something, it would bring up a bunch of things that were not relevant as the top hits, and you'd click on them, and it would just, like, no pretty icons for the new user to kind of like, yeah, that's what I want, a word processor. I know that's a word processor because there was a piece of paper on it and a pen, you know. I don't know, it just didn't strike me as visually fun.
Mint's one is
quite good.
I couldn't
agree more. It's just, Synaptic has just always seemed slow to me. Of course, probably it's because of my low bandwidth, because the first thing it does before it even comes up is do an update. But I have the same experience as Claude too. I never could find what I wanted in it. I was a lot better off if I didn't know what it was I wanted to install, do a Google search and find the package and then just do it through apt-get.
Okay, now, but what you said there, Klaatu, didn't make sense to me, because you said that dealing with repositories in the graphical user environment was problematic for you, and I think that's why everybody said Synaptic, because dealing with repos there is great, but you're actually talking about looking for software in the repositories, and that's maybe a little bit of a different story.
I meant browsing repositories. Are you saying you thought I meant adding and removing repositories?
Yeah, adding, removing, and managing them is pretty easy in Synaptic.
Yes, you're right. I agree with you. Yeah, no, I meant browsing.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah,
probably more specifically, I'm really talking for that mythical new user who I guess I'll never actually have to deal with, but I still think I will.
Oh, yeah, then I think Ubuntu's got it. They're I forget what it's even called. I haven't used it in a while. But
Software Center?
Is that it? Yeah, for browsing. That might be the best one.
I was going to say Mint has taken the Software Center, and I think theirs is nicer, simply for the fact that it's less complicated. It's less, they've simplified the idea and they've baked it down to something which is much less complicated at face value.
Okay, I'll have to look at Mint and I guess Ubuntu's. I'm just always curious to see these.
Yeah, I wouldn't bother, Klaatu. I don't think you're the target audience, mate.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So, but let me ask you, though, because you said you'd rather have the command line version, but how does that help a new user? Because you're not going to get icons or anything there either.
Yeah, I guess I'm speaking as two different people. I'm speaking as the sort of nagging conscience thinking, oh, we need to have pretty things for new users, and then what I actually want for myself, which is completely the opposite. So, yeah, you're right. That makes no sense.
Yeah. I think I find that the best browser for me is Firefox or iSweezer, and I'll just search for a package on the Debian. They've got a pretty good search, online search for their repos, and then I'll read the description there, and then I'll just install it on the command line.
Oh, that's an interesting way to do it. Sort of split it into two.
One thing that I don't think any of the software managers or package managers or anything have done, and we found this out in Tech and Coffee earlier this week, is equivalency to Windows and Mac popular software. The classic example that popped up was if you're looking for a GUI HTML WYSIWYG kind of thing, and trying to find one of those that's equivalent to the popular ones like Dreamweaver or whatever you use in the Windows environment, that's very tricky, and nobody's really got a handle on that yet, as far as I can see.
But that's what I'm saying. Is that not, that's not the job of the package manager, is it? I mean, or the GUI wrapping around the package manager. I think that's more the job of, you know, the social web and people recommending it. And so you just go into Google.
That's fine if you're hooked into those networks.
Yeah, if you're social.
Yeah, I think the whole idea, that's one of the reasons for Ubuntu doing their software center thing, is to actually go ahead and give like the newer users the quick way to find the most equivalent applications to fit their needs. And I kind of have some issues with that in some respects, because I think a lot of times there are applications that they're promoting over other ones that maybe aren't as good. But by the same token, I think that's the general idea, and maybe that's the right thing for a distro like Ubuntu to do.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know how their algorithms work for how they rate their software. Is it just done within the Ubuntu Software Center, or do they pull data sources from elsewhere? I don't know.
Well, it's always going to be a Wisdom of Solomon thing, because which one is the correct? Take the bog standard text editor issue. Which do you recommend as the best Unix text editor? And then you get into the whole Vi, Emacs, blah, 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 blah thing.
Yeah, but I think that's slightly different, because your average new user, I would imagine, would use something like Jedit or Mousepad or something. You know, they're not going to be looking for Vim, are they? Or are they? I don't know.
No, they're not. Even GVim they couldn't handle. I mean, it's just not something that a new user does.
Actually, there is a version of Vim that is designed for like general users that doesn't actually force you to use the command line or anything like that. You can actually do everything through shortcut keys. I forget what the name of it is, but it is actually there, so it could be used.
I say the same thing about Emacs, though, Sound Chaser, and I mean, because there's, I mean, GUI for Emacs, you know, it can be done, but I just think people, I don't know, I think there's a lot of just preconceived things of how things should work, and if it doesn't work that way, then they can't deal with it.
Yeah, it's surprising the issues that new users have. I mean, I introduced a friend of mine who's a long-time Windows user to Lubuntu a little while ago, and he just wanted to get a Linux distribution working on an old laptop that he had so he could have a poke around. And one of the buffers he hit into straight away was with his scanner. He wanted to scan a few old photographs that he had in. And he said, my scanner doesn't work with it. And I says, how do you know it's not working? And he says, well, I plugged it in and I couldn't see any of the driver packages installing, and I couldn't see the scanner interface. And I couldn't get across to him, you don't need one. You just open the, well, probably GIMP would probably be the way he wants to go. You just open GIMP and just grab the scanner from there, and it's all integrated, and there is no middleware, and there is no thing. So it's not necessarily a problem with Linux. It's just a different way of working that needs to be explained maybe a little bit more clearly in the GUI.
Oh, I think you've just summed up most issues with Linux, I mean, at this point. I mean, I honestly don't, the fact that we all use Linux all the time, I don't think there are that many problems with Linux as a user environment at this point. It's literally just that people grow up on other stuff and can't adjust to the idea that it might be different on another platform.
It's actually hurting Linux in this case, because it is too good and you don't need drivers externally.
That was the weird thing, the fact that it hasn't got a whole raft of middleware that you have to install to get things working. It does become very alien to them. And this was an argument I was having about recommendations on packaging, you know, where you get the little works with Mac symbols on boxes and works with Windows 7 and works with Windows 8 and stuff. And this is, it doesn't. That's the thing. What you actually have, when they say supported by Windows or made for Windows, is we've got the middleware hack fixes in the box. So why don't they make works with Linux on it? Because
that's if you're lucky, because nowadays they don't even do that. They don't do it in the box. You still have to go to the website and get all the fixes that they've discovered since they shipped the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just go, no, it doesn't work with Windows. You can hopefully get it hacked together to work with Windows, but it doesn't.
Yeah, I spent a good 2 hours over Christmas break discovering what you're talking about right now. Something that advertised itself to work on a computer platform that I don't use, and it just would not, it didn't work.
I actually bought a RAID card about 4 or 5 months ago, and it said that it supported Linux 2.6 at a minimum. It was like Linux 2.6 plus, and I just had plugged it in, and I just booted to Ubuntu server, and it worked immediately. And I was just like, oh, and like I was sort of taken aback that they had actually, you know, thought to make that work just out of the box.
Yeah, but my webcam the other day, creative one, and it actually says just works with Linux. It doesn't even have a qualification about, you know, which distro you need or anything. It just says works with Linux. And I plugged it in, and it worked with Linux. It's lovely.
You're all on about how brilliant Linux is. I spent a whole afternoon trying to configure a printer for my mother-in-law who was on Mint, and I could not get the thing to work. I was beating my head against the wall.
What brand of printer was it?
Well, actually, what happened was her printer was under the desk, and every time I plugged it in, there was a pop-up coming up on the screen, and the pop-up was gone by the time I came back. So by the time I had finished it, all I had to do was press the print button. Everything was already configured, knew where I was, everything was in A4. It was just the pop-up button had disappeared that microsecond longer than it took me to get from under the desk back up to see what was happening on the screen.
Actually, which version of Mint were you using there, Ken?
I have no idea.
I was going to say, because I am becoming a massive evangelist for Linux Mint, because it's the latest version especially is just brilliant. They've introduced this new thing on the little, I don't know whether you're supposed to call it a taskbar or a, you know, a tray or whatever you call it these days, but it's they've changed a little thing in the notifications where all the notifications don't just disappear once they've gone through Dbus. They actually sit there almost like an email inbox, so that if you've missed a notification, you can click on the notifications and it lists all the ones that you haven't acknowledged. It's brilliant.
I think you could do that in KDE already.
Yeah, I think that's probably the where they got the inspiration from.
Amazingly annoying.
But
no, it's not.
But they've
yes,
now
it
got
is.
It.
Fight.
You and your cute Razer stuff, you're all anti-KDE now. That's a nice feature.
No, it's terrible.
Well, then turn it off. It's in the config panel thing, system settings.
Or could I just add it to a database that I don't need on anymore?
Yeah, there's that.
There's an alternate one that works more like the one on Unity that you could install. They basically made a whole modular, so you could replace the whole notification system for a different one if you want.
And that the other thing with Mint that I was going to say was the when I installed this latest version, is it 14 now?
Yeah.
But yeah, I have a HP wireless printer, and as soon as I booted up for the first time, it just automatically configured the printer on the wireless network. I was like, whoa, that's very cool.
How did you handle the passwords for your wireless network, or is it unsecured?
Well, I was connected My main PC is connected to the wireless network on hardline, so it's got a Cat5 cable into the router. The printer was already connected to the wireless network securely, so when it found another thing on the network, it just said, "Oh, there's a printer. Lovely, we'll have that."
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. How did you get your printer to connect wirelessly with the password? Because every wireless printer I've tried to hook up, it wants you to use some Microsoft program to put your key in.
This one had one of those auto, so it had a red button on the router and a red button on the actual printer as well.
Oh, that thing, yeah.
Wi-Fi protected setup.
That's the baby.
Isn't that thing supposed to be terribly insecure?
Yes, it is. I actually use it to crack people's Wi-Fi, like, all the time, whenever they lose their stuff or can't get to it.
Is that the, is this the thing that shows up in, when you're, like, out and about and it says, like, HP setup or something like that?
Yes.
It's a, now is, yeah, okay.
Is Linux Mint still a derivative of Ubuntu, or are they transitioning away from that more?
Both. They have, their main distro is still based on Ubuntu. They have a side distro as well, which is the Debian edition.
I thought the Debian edition was kind of dead with the main dev of that moving over and running Solus OS.
Your information sounds like it might be newer than mine then. I've not looked at the Debian edition for a little while now.
Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, I've known a couple of people who have tried the Debian version, and by and large, they didn't seem overly impressed with it. I think it seems like it's a safer bet to go with the Ubuntu-based one.
Well, yeah, I mean, the main thing I certainly found with the Debian edition is I couldn't find what it added to Debian that wasn't already in Debian. So, if you want a Debian edition, just get Debian.
Philip, would you like to talk?
Hello?
Why would anyone run a distribution based on Debian that isn't Debian?
I don't know, really. Maybe added polish.
Why Ubuntu is based on Debian.
If you wanted a better defaults or different defaults, different installer... if you wanted a different
nice
set of core packages,
once you boot it up.
If you wanted KDE as a default desktop, or maybe if you wanted maybe a little more current KDE packages, because Debian's a little slow with that, and the 4.0 transition was kind of rough, so you wanted the latest one. You might want to have one that has the Debian core packages, but KDE has its own different repository that's part of your distro.
Yeah, someone. I think they emailed. It was an email message to me, and they were basically saying, you know, thank you for working on Crunchbang and stuff. And they said something which kind of stuck with me, and that was that, you know, Debian. It's an absolutely fantastic system, but it's almost as if it's a communist state, and they imprisoned all their artists, and basically, you know, it's so what you get with Debian is pretty much it's what the upstream want you to have. They do very, very few changes. So, you know, in a similar fashion to how Ubuntu started, and they just made Ubuntu look nice and aimed it at users. I think that's what you get downstream from Debian. You get that little bit of added polish, which is you may be lacking Debian. But I don't think... I'm not saying that as a negative to Debian, because that's what I love about Debian. I think it's just...
It's sort of like a rock that the rest of the community is tied to, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
And then and how in some of that is Debian any different than Slackware, from what I hear from a lot of, you know, diehard Slackware guys, that, you know, or even, you know, Slackware more so in some cases, that it's even more vanilla than Debian.
Yeah, Slackware is pretty much vanilla, but I use KDE and I like the Oxygen look and feel and the Air theme for the Plasmoid, so I'm pretty happy with the way it looks.
To be honest, I don't think you can have too many rocks to be applied to. You know, it's kind of reassuring that there are these very stable distros, but importantly, more than one of them. So you've got different directions to go in if you want to.
But I guess the biggest point I'll come back to with Linux Mint for me is, why do these guys keep tying their ship to Ubuntu? I mean, it just seems like more trouble than it's worth with as much as they're starting to separate themselves from Ubuntu, unless it's just they don't have the developer resources to do some of the things that just letting Ubuntu handle for them is easier.
I think that's right. But I think that's maybe a little bit harsh on Ubuntu, in that we have a tendency, I think, in the community to forget just how much good work they do underneath the interface. So if you take Unity out of the equation and then look at the sum of what Ubuntu adds to Linux as a whole, that's a very big body of work that needs to be done, and I think that's why they do it, is because they want to create an everyman system which goes in a slightly different direction at the interface level, but still has all the good work that Ubuntu does.
I mean, just install Ubuntu Server and you'll see that. I mean, that's a great piece of software.
Amen.
Debian is a great piece of software on the server.
That's true.
I was going to say, back to what...
I'm kind of a fan of CentOS on the server side of things.
Yeah, I just like my operating system to be less binary, in that whoop-de-doo if Microsoft happens to distribute what you want and need, but you haven't got any choices if you're hooked into that tool chain and it doesn't do what you want or need.
That's what it's all about. Freedom from that.
Going back to the Mint Ubuntu thing, I think I'm not sure how much of it stems from the Ubuntu installer, because I think the Ubuntu installer, is it Ubiquiti? That's probably one of the better installers on the market, and I think they do a really good job at that. So I'm not sure how much of Mint being based on Ubuntu is purely down to the fact that the installer is so good.
Yeah, both installers I've found have been extremely good, and they're still pushing on that front as well.
Yeah, they're constantly developing Ubiquiti, and you know, it's in comparison to, because for Crunchbang I use the standard Debian installer, so you know it doesn't run. Well, it can run from a live environment, but it's best not to. Let's put it like that. And, you know, in comparison to Ubiquiti, I would imagine for a new user, it looks quite clunky. I mean, it's not. It's really powerful, and you can do lots of stuff, and you can pre-seed it and, you know, make it pretty much do anything you want. But from a user standpoint, I would, you know, I don't think there's any real comparisons. I think Ubiquiti sort of like is, you know, head and shoulders above pretty much everything else out there. And I think the Mint developers probably know that, and you know that's why they're happy to stick with Ubuntu. And they've also got the added proprietary stuff. So in comparison to Debian, things like installing NVIDIA cards on Debian can be a bit of a pain in the ass for some people, especially sort of like, again, new users. But in Ubuntu, they've, you know, pretty much got it down to a fine art, where it's a, you know, it's just a couple of clicks of a button and it's done for you. So
there's also one thing that gets underrated and forgotten about is the WUBI thing from Ubuntu as well. That's brilliant. If you're trying to convert a Windows enthusiast over, that makes it very easy.
I think they've stopped. They've actually stopped developing that, I think.
Yes, they've stopped developing it, but it still just works. It does do a very good job.
But yeah, it won't just path back.
For anyone who's, you know, wanting to check things out, I just point them to VirtualBox anymore. I've just kind of started telling people that who have an interest in trying it that I think a dual boot is kind of a dangerous situation to get involved in.
I've been a fan of the dual boot. If you set it up properly, that's the whole thing. It's kind of tricky to get it all set up.
I have been burned on a dual boot because of printer drivers once. So I just think VirtualBox is a better choice.
I would agree with that mainly. I'd just put one little caveat in that I've only ever been burned on dual boot when I've tried to install Ubuntu first, or you know, Linux first, and then Windows second. And that sort of indicates to me the benefits of a Linux system, because Linux will play nicely with virtually anything else which has to be installed, whereas Windows doesn't want to know that it's been installed alongside everything else. You have to sort of go in around it.
What about big Windows updates? Does that ever clobber your
The closest
grub?
Thing I'll tell people to do for a dual boot is to put a second hard drive in their machine and to use the boot option or the boot from option through their BIOS.
Yeah, that's probably a really good alternative if they have a second drive bay.
You could also install to a SD card, which works pretty nicely sometimes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I've got a Windows 7 installation on an SSD playing alongside a Mint installation perfectly fine, and haven't had any problems with that yet. It's just if you try and tell it and go through all the, you know, the registration key and license key installations on a new Windows installation where there's already a Linux installation, that's where you get the problems.
Sounds like the problem isn't dual booting, but Windows.
That's what I was alluding to, definitely.
That's one thing I definitely do not miss, having to do with all those licenses and registration. I just never had that since using GNU Linux.
Hasn't everybody forgot about Live CD, too?
We want to forget.
Oh, no, I don't. I love Live CDs.
Yeah, me too. I absolutely
CDs
need
great,
them.
But yeah. The people I've dealt with are typically just savvy enough that they understand how to do some things, and a Live CD, the couple times I put people in front of it, it kind of throws them because it's running a lot lower than they think it should be. And I've actually seen better performance running something inside a VirtualBox than off a Live CD. And it gives them the option of being able to install things, play with things, and a little better than a Live CD will.
Hey, Lord D, can you increase your mic volume just a little bit? You're coming across very low, probably lower than me even.
Turn it all the way up to 11.
All I can do is try to eat the phone a little better.
I use VirtualBox at work. I've got the host machine is a Windows 7 machine, and I run Crunchbang in a virtual system on top of that. Got dual monitors, and you know it works brilliantly. So, in fact, if you didn't know otherwise, you'd be mistaken to think that it runs on the bare metal. It's pretty quick. So, yeah, I love VirtualBox. I think it's brilliant.
Does anybody use QEMU?
Yeah, that's what I use.
Yeah, I use that for testing Crunchbang images once I've finished burning them.
Do you use a GUI wrapper around it, or do you configure it directly?
It just runs for a shell script.
I just type it into the shell. I mean,
does anyone remember KQEMU and whatever exactly happened to that whole thing exactly?
I think it's still around.
Yeah, pretty quickly I got used to all the line commands, although now they've changed them a little bit, but you just get used to that and then you don't really need the GUI wrapper anymore.
Did you do a show on that or no?
No, I was on the Nightcast with Nightwise talking about Proxmox. I was just... KQEMU was a kernel module for QEMU that sped it up, and I just wondered if, like, KQEMU became, like, KVM or something, or if that's something completely different.
Oh, yeah. No, QEMU can use KVM now, for sure. I didn't know that's what you were... I thought KQEMU... was a GUI wrapper or something.
And now for a short advertising break. Giant's virtual solutions can use KVM.
I thought you didn't work for them yet, Black Crow.
Starting early. Early bird catches the worm.
I feel like we should forward this to whoever your manager is going to be.
Yeah.
in order to, you know, get some points with you.
I was pitching to Airbus about how they could use virtualized tool chains to replace redundant equipment. already got that one sorted.
Are you? Do you do like Unix stuff now at your current job, Black Crow, or Linux, or what?
Yeah, I finished with Airbus on the 21st of December, and what I was doing with them was using Unix boxes to take surveys of all their licensing arrangements. So I'd survey the entire company once every 15 minutes to see who was using what tools. That's where I was before.
That is oddly similar to what I do, Black Crow.
Yeah, it's becoming a very popular field. I mean, when you're talking about, say, a CATIA seat costing somewhere in the region of £5,000 per seat per year, you have to know how many of them are being used.
Has anybody rewatched Jurassic Park? Saw the scene where they said it's a Unix system?
Oh, yes.
That's actually the only part of Jurassic Park I've ever seen. It was on YouTube.
You should watch it.
I'd rather go back and watch the movie, or read the book, I mean.
But what about the part where the Velociraptors open doors?
That's in the book as well.
But you don't get to see it.
We actually had a lady called Sue, who was deeply eccentric. She just wandered around the place. She's only about 4 foot high. She just wandered around the place with a sort of hunchback, mumbling to herself, and she was the IBM mainframe controller.
Oh, nice. That's hilarious. What did the mainframes run on, do you know?
AIX, probably, maybe, I'm guessing.
Sue carried them around on her back.
Yeah, I think that's what the hunch was. And it was very strange. It was like, oh, she keeps hold of the dinosaur enclosure.
She was like,
apparently,
the,
that was originally Unix, though.
AIX?
I'm sure somebody will Google it. I'm too busy writing scripts at the minute, but it was an experimental version of Unix that they were running there.
If you're talking about in Jurassic, actually,
yeah, in that.
IRIX. I'm pretty sure that was IRIX.
They had a 3D file manager. That was a little weird.
FSN. Go to wikipedia.org, FSN. Foxtrot Sierra November.
Wonder what they're using for the login manager.
Actually, if we're going to go old school, what was the system that they were running in War Games with Matthew Broderick?
That film was on today, I think.
Oh, was it? Oh, cool.
That was a mainframe operating system, like a PDP operating system, I believe.
It was C-something, E/PM or something like that.
Oh, CPM? Well, okay, so the machine that in Matthew Broderick's room is actually an old MSAI, I-M-S-A-I 8080 machine, which was just an S100 bus that you plug the CPU card into. Most typically had an 8080 processor. And yeah, they did run CPM on them, which actually was a digital computing product at one point. And that's actually the operating system that DOS was based on.
I've died and gone to geek heaven.
I am reading right here that it's actually called IMDOS, the version in War Games. It's a modified version of CPM.
Oh, okay. Well, that could be. One of the first machines I ever worked on was actually one of those MSI 8080 boxes, and I got to play with the toggle switches on the front panel and try to program it that way. It was never successful, but I had fun trying to do it.
That's what's missing from computing these days, is there's not enough switches and little flashy lights. I miss them.
One of the more interesting file system managers I ever saw was actually a version of the original Doom, where you could run around and shoot things inside of the game that represented files, and when you shot it, it would delete the file.
Can I just stop everyone just to say Happy New Year to China and Beijing, Hong Kong, Manila, Singapore?
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year,
Happy New Year, China!
They have their own date system, so they don't apply, surely.
Yeah, actually, you're probably right.
Wow, the Nubros are on this. This is great.
We've got a countdown on one of our many monitors on our table.
Yeah, I think you guys don't have enough ThinkPads.
All right, so...
Oh, yeah, we do like our ThinkPads in this family.
I don't know where I saw this gag, just going back to what we were talking about, but not enough buttons and flashy lights, but there was a gag in a TV program somewhere. It might have been, and he's and they said, but if the serve guy stays in there like 24/7, how does he eat? And somebody replied, oh no, he doesn't. He's just learnt to photosynthesize from LED lights.
Nice. Awesome.
It's the IT crowd.
Oh, was that it? Was that it? All right.
Now, all right, so if you guys used, I hate to bring it over to the Windows side, but there's been something puzzling me forever, is back in probably 2001, 2002, before I'd even heard of Linux, I bought a Windows computer, and there was a program on there, I think it was called Visio, and when you opened it, everything kind of seemed like it was all red and line art, and I don't know, it seemed, maybe it was a file image, I don't know what that thing was, I never figured out what the heck it was or what it was supposed to do. Did anybody ever see that thing and know what that was?
That's still in use.
Yeah, it's a spreadsheet application, basically.
Really?
I thought it was for drawing diagrams.
It is for diagrams.
Yeah, I guess I got confused. I was thinking VisiCalc, which is the old spreadsheet, versus Visio.
I use Visio at work. It's really good for doing the diagrams, flow charts, stuff like that.
Does it save to open document format?
No, but in the latest version of LibreOffice will finally have Visio support. And my personal opinion, Visio was an excellent application up until version 2, which coincidentally was when Microsoft took it, and it turned into a big pile of crud after that. Thank you. Goodbye.
How
I wonder if there was any coincidence, Visio, though.
For the people who use Visio, how does something like Dia stack against it?
It's ugly compared to the... It works exactly in the same way. It's actually easier to use. The problem is, again, it's an entrenched market now. Everybody's got diagrams in Visio, and the Visio diagrams are tidier and nice 3D arty graphics, whereas the ones in Dia tend to be ugly, 2D ugly ones.
And yeah, I agree with Ken on that. Other thing is that they're starting to build some of those capabilities into LibreOffice as well, into the drawing app.
Has anybody used the new CalligraOffice?
There's a review of it in this month's, or the latest Linux Format magazine. I'll just turn to that, because I happen to have it here, surprisingly, and see what it says about it.
I haven't used it, but I've been curious as to how they're doing. Are you asking because you tried it?
I've used it. I actually kind of like it. I think they finally made an interface that's designed around widescreens that are actually in use. They have everything in a sidebar that is all accessible. All the buttons are all there. And you could do quite a bit of interesting things with it. With the text boxes and whatnot, you could rotate things and drag on objects, and it has the basic supports for headers, footers, and page counts, that sort of thing. I like it. It also has good importing of the Microsoft formats, but it doesn't save to them.
I tried it not too long ago, and the thing just crashed and burned pretty hard on me, but I haven't tried it since like 2 or 3 updates ago, and the thing I'm most interested in is checking out Author when it comes out.
That seemed like a really neat idea, basically creating a tool designed for authors to publish ebooks.
It seems like Calligra is really positioning themselves not to be an office suite, but a suite of tools for people doing creative endeavors instead.
Krita actually has their own foundation now.
Where's Lawson in Bronx when you need him?
I was going to say, the Linux format has some very interesting conclusions when it comes to office suite and Calligra in particular. One of the sections of their review is on other tools, what else have they got? And it says Caligra has the most productivity apps. It has Plan for Project Management, which can create Gantt charts, and Flow for drawing flow charts. The latest edition includes an app for writing ebooks called Author that's similar to iBooks Author and can export EPUBs besides a general purpose note-taking app called Brain Dump.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to call the end of my day already. I will see whoever's around later this evening.
Bye, Lord D.
Take it easy, man. Happy New Year.
See you, Lord D. Bye.
Bye, Lord D.
Sure, bye.
This might be a good opportunity to say hello.
Haha, hello, Dave.
Hi, Phil, how are you? Bug. Hey, Becky, you alright?
Hi, everybody.
Dave, I'm still working on your stream, dude. I haven't forgotten you.
That's all right. I thought I'd just take this opportunity to bring the kids on board, if that's all right.
Oh,
please
no.
Do, yeah, cool.
More the merrier.
Hold right, on, let me mute Becky first.
Say hello to the kids. I'm sorry, say hello, kids.
Hi. Hello.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
Hi, hello. It's America. Happy New Year.
Ah, yeah, indeed. Happy New Year. You've got a little way to go yet, haven't you, in America?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, we're 8 hours to go here in the UK. But yeah, so how's it going so far then?
13 hours in New England.
No, you're on the East Coast, aren't you?
Yes.
It's been really boring, Dave. They're just talking about tech and stuff.
You know, like... I expected nothing else, to be honest with you, Phil. I mean, you know, with this being a sort of a bunch of techies, you know, none of this... You know, shooting the breeze about weather and you know, what you've been eating and what presents you got over Christmas and whatever. And so, no, I expected people to be talking about office suites, and there was a conversation in the IRC earlier on about text editors and such like that.
Oh, yeah, we've done that. And Vi won.
There has been no general chit-chat.
What about Kate? They have their own Vi mode.
Here we go.
Kate's pretty good, actually.
I use Genie.
I'm using Kate right now.
I can't tell you what I use.
Has Kate given her permission?
She loves us.
Like, I feel like we should pronounce Kate like K8, like the same way GNU. Yeah, GNU. K8.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers.
I think that's crazy.
Nurse, he's out of bed again.
So it starts.
Ken Fallon, ladies and gentlemen. Ken Fallon.
The real Ken Fallon.
Yeah, Chopcom hasn't
week?
Been in.
He's in the IRC.
Oh, tell him to come and say hello. That was excellent when he did his, this is the fake Ken Fallon.
Yeah, who was that? That was great.
Yeah, he's too afraid to talk to me.
Chocoholm.
Has he not spoken to you since it happened, Ken?
No.
Yes,
I nearly
sure.
died I'm when I heard it.
This is the fake Ken Fallon here.
Oh, to be sure, and I'm eating my Lucky Charms.
It'll be grand.
It'll be grand.
Grand.
Oh, shite.
Kids on the stream.
I nearly wept myself when I heard that.
Hey, it was good. Right, the kids are asking, when are they going to talk? Talk now.
Yeah, talk now.
Say something. Speak into the microphone there. Speak up and they'll hear you.
Hello.
There you go.
Hello.
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 What's your
name? Happy New Year.
Happy New
Happy
Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year!
Are you going to go to bed, or will Daddy let you stay up the whole time?
Let's stay up because it's New Year's Eve.
The whole time?
As long as we can.
Ooh, and what if you fall asleep? Will they wake you up, do you think?
The fireworks will wake you up.
We just have to go upstairs.
Ah.
Are we going to have a...
Are you going to be getting drunk later?
What did you say?
Speaking of the microphone.
What did you say?
Are you going to be getting drunk later?
No, we don't drink beer.
Oh, thank goodness. Did your dad buy you fireworks?
No. Did I? What do you mean, did I?
No.
It's only Ken Fallon that's the irresponsible father in this chat room.
Well, Ken's kids get fireworks. I think fireworks. You should have them too.
As long as you let them off outside.
Ken's going to strap his kids to them.
Sometimes the thought has crossed my mind. But we've got them champagne. Did you get champagne?
We've got champagne. We got it when we got married and we haven't opened it yet.
If you have enough sparklers, you'll be surprised what you can do with them.
That was a conversation killer.
No, wait, were you... Who said that? Sorry, I missed whose little lights lit up.
It was me.
Were you at Southeast Linux Fest that year?
No.
Okay, I thought maybe that was a reference to something that happened that almost took a couple of lives, I think.
Will someone have like 300 of them rubber banded together?
Yes. I thought it would be a great idea to light them. It was insane.
You could also grind them up.
Ooh.
Oh, interesting.
That wouldn't last long, would it?
Is this turning into the Jolly Rogers cookbook?
Yeah, I think so.
Might as well just buy a barrel of gunpowder.
Yay!
Well, if you grind them up, make sure you don't create any sparks, so anti-static spray is a must. And make sure you're grounded.
Wear those little wrist straps.
Did you get that, kids? Make sure you're grounded.
Yeah, they're looking at me, they're looking at me with a... You'll be grounded if you try any of this.
Yeah. Don't.
They're looking
do
at
it.
Me with their eyebrows raised, not knowing what you're talking about.
Good.
Are they excited to be getting a little baby soon?
Yes, we are.
How's Mummy? Is she feeling any better?
She's okay.
She's okay now.
What did Santa bring for Christmas?
Mushy Monsters DS game.
Lego?
Yes.
Lots of Lego, didn't you?
We got Lego from Santa.
I may have seen a photograph of it all.
Wow.
Did you get a Raspberry Pi?
What?
No, but Daddy did.
Oh, you got to share.
Well, I've got three of them now, so, you know, there's always that that option.
One for each of the kids that you keep producing.
Did you get any new socks?
Did you get new socks, girls?
Yes, we did.
And I did too.
I got new socks too. I was thrilled.
I got so many socks.
I'm not wearing socks right now. I'm not too.
I am. In fact, I'm wearing socks Becky bought me for Christmas.
They're gonna be staying in here all day.
They've got Muppets on them.
So Mummy said she's not gonna put on the socks.
I bought Philip Waldorf and Statler socks.
Oh, fantastic!
Oh, that's cool.
That makes a lot of sense.
Family Guy socks.
See, Klaatu, you scoff, but socks is the Tickle Me Elmo of 2012.
Oh, I love. I'm not scoffing. I love socks. I go through socks at an alarming rate. I don't know. I must be walking wrong. I always wear out the heels and the toes.
No, that's
try
my
changing
pick.
Them.
Oh, I got it. Okay, I'll try it.
My
pick. It's all Klaatu's walking around barefoot with his urban camping.
Yeah, I do a lot of walking, but I feel like I must be walking incorrectly or something. I don't know. I'm gonna work on it this year.
I got my new socks are completely synthetic. They're not cotton anymore, and they seem to be lasting forever. So I asked for more of those for Christmas.
I bet that's it. Is the change of everything to cotton? Because I've got socks from when I was in college, and they're perfectly good, except all the elastic's gone out of them. But yeah, the ones I buy today, it seems like they last 6 weeks, and I got to get another pair.
Are we allowed to ask how long it was since you went out of college?
25 years.
You are joking. You're wearing socks that are 25 years old.
Wear them. I just haven't thrown them out. They're in the bottom of the drawer for when I run out of good socks, then I get a pair of those out. That the only thing is that they want to slide down, but because the elastic's bad. But other than there's no holes in the bottom or anything. Like these ones I buy now, you know, I got to buy a new package of socks every 6 weeks, it seems like.
I'm still in telling jokes that are 25 years old. There's nothing wrong with 25-year-old stuff, you know.
Are you sure?
There was a Kickstarter for something called Socrates that it had carbon fiber and what's that material? Kevlar woven in with it, so the socks wouldn't wear down.
Do you kids want to get 25-year-old socks next Christmas?
I don't think so.
No, me neither.
Anyway, one of us is not doing this anymore.
Yeah, Kara's disappeared.
Me.
Oh, okay.
Can I just tell you a very quick story that happened on Christmas Day? The kids got a lot of clothes for Christmas, and we went to church on Christmas Day morning, and Amy went in and spoke to our minister and said, "We're wearing all new clothes, all except..." What did you say?
Pants.
Awesome.
And she didn't say it quietly like she did now. She shouted it out, going, "All my new clothes except my knickers!"
Anta laughed when I was saying it.
That's a bit like Emma. Becky took Emma to see Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy once in the cinema. And what did she say?
Oh, I can't remember.
Emma was quite young at the time. What was she, about 7 or 8?
Yeah.
And right at the end of the show, the film, he swears, he says something naughty. And Emma said, "He just said a swear word."
In a packed cinema.
Brilliant. At the top of her lungs, probably.
Like her mum, so yes.
So, Dave. We've done like a round robin and explained to everybody what we're using our Raspberry Pis for. You said you got 3 of them. So what do you use them for?
Well, I have got 2 256 meg ones that I got from the original launch. One of them was being used as an XBMC media center, which I have now since swapped out and used the 512 one that I just received on it instead. So I have 2 256 meg RAM Raspberry Pis sitting in a box doing nothing. So any suggestions of something practical to use them for would be very welcome.
IRC.
But
was that IRC?
Yes, like an IRC relay or something, so you can stay persistently connected to wherever you're IRCing.
Oh, like a BNC box.
Right.
Right, yeah. I could use my VPN for that. So, but I mean, being on the back end of a broadband connection's not persistence, not really the buzzword.
How about getting a USB wireless card and using it as a wireless print server?
That would be a good idea. We do have a 3COM print server, but it only satisfies one USB connection, so we can only get one printer to it, and there's 2 that I want to connect to it. So I suppose, yeah, we could do that. Go on, what are you going to say?
Thanks.
You weren't going to say
that. I just like going like...
Yes, thank you.
Print servers, they're just comical.
Clearly, yes.
The So have you not got any use for it for the Bugcast that you could use it for?
I suppose if I got a decent like a portrait monitor, I could stick it on the screen and on the wall and use it as a show notes thing rather than having to switch backwards and forwards from between windows on my laptop. But I can't really think of anything practical to use it for. I mean, we've already got a VPS, so you know, I've got an Icecast server running on there actually at this moment because we're relaying this on one of our Icecast servers. But I can't think of anything else specifically that I could use it for on the show.
A soundboard, possibly?
Is my name Fab?
I don't know. Is your name Fab?
Who's the Indian? Sorry, who was that? What you want to say something? What do you want to say?
We got new DVDs and we only watched 2 of them.
How many DVDs did you
get? Gosh, how many are left?
I don't know. I haven't counted, really.
There weren't that many.
But we're watching Romeo and Juliet and the Smurfs.
Cool. Did you get any Muppets DVDs? Muppets are my favorite.
No, but we did get little, puppet toys.
Oh, those are pretty rad. Can you make them talk?
You can if you actually talk with your hand in them, going like the Pac-Man movement for the mouth.
Yeah, I was going to say, unfortunately, hand signals don't work on audio conversations.
They weren't made out of 25-year-old socks, were they?
No, they were not. They were real puppets.
This kid knows Pac-Man. That's incredible.
That's
awesome.
When the Google Doodle was a workable Pac-Man game, she saw it for the first day, and every day for about the next month, she said, "Oh, can we play Google Pac-Man? Play Google Pac-Man." She loves it.
Did she beat it?
No.
I would be even more impressed if that was true.
Give it time. She's 7. Come on.
That's true.
Maybe you could set up your Raspberry Pi as a dedicated Pac-Man client.
Yeah, use MAME.
MAME is pretty...
Has anybody got MAME running up on a Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, it wouldn't run. That's pretty intensive.
Oh, it's a bummer. A Raspberry Pi MAME cabinet would be beautiful.
It would be.
No, I think I saw on an Ars Technica article. I thought there was someone who was, maybe it wasn't MAME, but it was something like that on a Raspberry Pi. I'll dig up the article.
I saw that too. They built a little cabinet, but it was like their, it couldn't have been MAME because they only had 4 games with this emulator and none of them ran very well, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Has anybody clustered Raspberry Pis yet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there have been some supercomputers made by Raspberries, yeah.
And how have they been connected?
Ethernet. I don't know. There's a
GPIO port.
I think there's Southampton University. I think they created the first supercomputer out of Raspberry Pis.
Awesome. I might give that a check.
Doing it just Ethernet?
I thought they were piggybacking the GPIO ports, but I could be wrong.
Well, there's
I saw one that used the Ethernet and just like a cluster.
Yeah, that's the Southampton one. They connect it via Ethernet.
Not that funny.
I know. We got a spinning top and then we discovered it was actually a pen with a spinning top, like, spinning top shape.
Amy?
Did it draw swirls all over your floor?
What?
Did it draw swirls all over your floor when you spun it like a top?
No. There's a pen lid on it.
Oh, thank goodness for lids.
Sorry. Becky, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask Amy when she's going to record her own episode.
I don't know when. That depends if his daddy lets me.
Do you want to do it, though?
Yes, I would like to do that.
They have co-hosted. Amy, I think it was episode 5. No, it wasn't 5. 12. Yeah. Amy co-hosted. And we've had the kids on one of the more recent shows, and I have to say the show just descended into complete and total mayhem. It was interesting, to say the least.
Your nanopodmo as well.
Yeah, they did that as well, but that doesn't, well, say it doesn't count, of course it counts, but yeah, that was quite manic as well.
It kept me amused for 12 minutes.
I was going to say, my sister noticed how technology has changed kids recently. See, I've got one nephew that's 6 years old and another 2 nephews that are both 2. And all of them do the same thing, which we never did as kids, and that is when you take a photograph, either with your camera phone or with your normal cameras these days, as soon as the picture's taken, they run round and have a look at the LCD screen to see what the picture's like. And, of course, when we were kids, you didn't do that because they had to be sent back to the developers and you had to get the film developed before you see the phone. And you just thought, wow, how massive a change is that?
Yeah, and if you're like my parents, you didn't take that many photographs, so you had to wait till the roll of film was filled up. So it was like 2.5 years later before you actually saw the pictures.
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
You never had a Polaroid then?
No, we weren't posh kids like you were.
No, I didn't have a Polaroid either, actually.
We couldn't afford a Polaroid. They were quite expensive back in the day.
Yeah, they weren't cheap.
Comparatively expensive, should I say.
I don't think they're cheap.
The camera wasn't expensive. It was the film.
Did you guys ever hear that song, that George Rabb song, it's When I Was Your Age?
No.
It's a line in there about having to bring your film to a man who lived in a booth. It's a pretty funny song.
Well, that brings up something I thought of the other day. Maybe I bet it would fit. I've got a couple old antique Brownie cameras, but of course there's so many of them, they're not worth anything. I was thinking that might make a good case. Got one and put an RPI in it, figure out something to do with it.
Oh, you know what? That reminds me. Since we're talking about that,
the kid
my wife
gotten a I think it was an 8x10 or 5x7 glass plate camera.
That's cool. My wife finally gave up her film camera and got a digital one, and she just got her last roll of film back from the developer, and you know had it put to CD, and of course it was the wrong person's CD. We got the wrong people's film.
Ooh.
The very last one. What a way to end it, huh?
To him and say, hey, I would like my actual pictures.
Oh, yeah. She went and got it back. Fortunately, they had the right negatives in the little folder with it.
Yeah, I have to say, as technology battles go, it seems like film did like the worst job of trying to hold its own. You know, it just it didn't do us any favors as it was dying. I mean, I guess it's still dying, but I mean, they haven't gone down in price. It's just getting messier and messier. It's just they're making themselves less attractive the better digital cameras get. It's really bizarre.
But there's still a market for film. That's the thing. The film gives certain things that digital imagery can't give you. The graininess and the tonal quality of film is actually far superior to that of digital. Look at the difference between video recorded films or television programs and filmed television programs. There's such a difference, and there is still a market for it.
Yeah, there was a photographer recently said to me that the big difference between film and digital is the resolution on film is infinite, which is kind of profound.
No, it can't
it's
be
not,
inf-
it's not
yes,
infinite.
It is infinite because it's organic. There's no pixels there.
No, but there's chemicals, and you're limited to the size of the chemical.
Well, and silver halides. I mean, it's silver halides on film, so there is definitely a limit. But what happens is when you look at film, you actually have an infinite number of frames, because as long as you can actually move faster, you can actually have more halides, and there is no limitation there as far as that goes, excepting for whatever your motor moves at. What I thought was always interesting about this switch to digital is that a company like Kodak actually really kind of botched everything. They early on knew that digital photography was going to come into things, and they actually had a number of, you know, the patents and things on stuff, and yet they didn't do anything to try to bridge the two between film and digital.
In a lot of ways, I'm kind of glad they didn't take advantage of their patents, because we'd be in a lot worse state now, wouldn't we?
Right, guys, we're going to be heading off very shortly. Just thought I'd mention, we spoke about having the kids on the show. The last time we had the kids on the show, I said it was quite recently. It wasn't. It was over 2 years ago, August 2010. I posted the link into the Mumble chat room if anybody wants to pick that up and carry it, pick it up and listen to it later on. But we're off, and we will be back later on. Say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Happy New Year.
See you
Bye.
Later.
Happy New Year. Bye. Have a good one.
Thanks for stopping in. Happy New Year.
Has anybody heard about the Franken camera project?
The what? Say it again.
I'm just looking at that right now.
Is that half digital, camera? Half film?
No, it's like a programmable open source camera. It looks pretty good, and they have like an API that can make a regular, you know, crummy cell phone camera make pretty decent pictures.
What's the advantage of this over, you know, a lot of like the DSLR type cameras? I mean, it would seem to me that DSLRs actually have a higher resolution in that than working with like a camera phone, and they have the optics in that you get with this.
The advantage of this camera is that you don't have to wear like a nerdy t-shirt to let your freak flag fly.
You could actually program it and have it control the camera in ways that it normally wouldn't do. So basically, you're at the mercy of whatever your camera functions are. With a Franken camera, you could program your own routines or tell it to focus in certain ways and do digital tricks with it that normally your camera wouldn't be able to do.
There's also a lot of differences between, like in digital cameras, there's a lot of differences between what amounts of compression they're applying to what you get out of the camera. So, you know, in terms of color correction and stuff like that, there could be a big variation there. I don't know much about all of them that are out there, but that's one difference.
You could just shoot in RAW, though, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Do I ever save the ping? PNGs?
Well, oh, no, they save to .jpgs.
Yeah, I've seen RAW and JPGs as the two options.
I have a new Canon Rebel, and it will shoot as either a RAW or a JPEG, one or the other.
Not a big fan of JPEG.
Well, the way I've seen it, and I don't know if this is the way that it works on yours, Thano, but it'll shoot RAW, and then it'll save like a JPEG copy of that RAW. So the JPEG, I think, is just sort of mid almost as a quick and easy preview, something to look at and kind of play around with before you actually switch over to using the RAW.
I can set it as either, actually. I can set it as just JPEG, just RAW, or both.
Oh, okay.
I had to update Photoshop to get it to interpret the RAWs for my camera.
Have any of you guys heard of this CHDK thing that Pipeman's talking about in the IRC?
No, I hadn't heard about that.
Oh, Canon, yes.
Hacker dev kit?
Yes, I have heard about this. Also, along with Magic Lantern.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of Magic Lantern. Yeah.
It's very much like Magic Lantern.
This looks very cool. It's like Rockbox, but for your camera.
There was one model of camera. It was one of the ones with the better sensors. They would use it with Magic Lantern, and then they would use it for like professional videography. So people would like shoot films that way, because you would actually get better quality on that than you would get with anything anywhere near that price range, except for like renting a Red.
What's it called again?
Magic Lantern.
Have you used that? And how do you say your nick? Fathano?
Fathano. It's like Fathalo. Like the blue.
Oh, okay.
I have used Magic Lantern, yeah. It's a 5D Mark II or a 7D is usually the cameras that they would use. Which
are
way,
are
way cheaper. I don't know now. I'll look to see how much they are.
I think they're about... You said the 5D, is that what you said?
The 5D Mark II is $1,800.
Oh, is it that low now? Is that just the body, then?
That is just the body.
Okay.
Oh, it's even less, according to my scripts in Chrome. You can get it for $900 on eBay, apparently.
That would be worth it, too. Those are nice cameras for,
yes,
for being digital.
Very, very nice.
When I saw the DSLRs, like when I really started to shoot DSLR for real, like on projects, I just, that's kind of when I was just finally like, okay, the trouble involved, the cost and the trouble involved with film is no longer worth it now.
When I started seeing the burst fire stuff, that's when I knew it was a technology that couldn't be competed with by any other traditional means.
I don't know what burst fire is. What is that?
You can rapidly take pictures in succession for things like fast photography. And you're getting up to like 15 frames per second that you can take. It's insane.
That's really cool.
Another thing is it could take burst shots and you could focus at different lengths and then combine the pictures together to have like a wide focus view.
Right.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's really cool. Adjust your focus post photography. That's really cool.
And there was that demo a while ago where they unblurred the picture in Photoshop. Like, this was for the CS5 demonstration. Like, they were just like, oh yeah, so we figured out an algorithm to unblur photos, and then they just did it, and then the audience just completely lost it because they realized what that means.
Yeah, wow.
I'd never seen an audience do anything like that, especially on like a YouTube recording. It was really weird.
Have you got a link to that YouTube?
I am pulling it up because it's...
I think it's YouTube.com.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, there you go, YouTube.
That'll be narrowing it right down. Thank you.
No problem.
YouTube. I think I'm spelling it wrong.
It's Y-O-U, not just U. It's Y-O-U.
If you're using KDE, right, just open up KRunner and type YT colon.
I found it.
How do you spell tube?
T-O-O-B, isn't it?
Right.
That's what I thought. It's still not coming up. It's coming up with some prawn site. No, I'm only kidding. Greetings from the U.S.
T-U-B-E. Y-O-U-T-U-B-E.
Are you on the East Coast or West Coast, Geospart?
Geospart, yes. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, normally from New York there.
Oh, cool.
Wow, this YouTube thing is pretty cool. There's like videos and stuff here.
Oh, it's, are there? I just get a bunch of things that say you don't have Flash installed, and I generally navigate away.
Why don't I do?
Install Flash, and you get to see cool commercials.
Oh, sounds worth it.
You install AdBlock over that.
Oh, people can comment on your videos as well, and you get really helpful feedback on your videos.
I never seen that being the case. The comments I usually see on YouTube just seem to be... just horrible. But Klaatu, as far as being able to watch YouTube videos, get the Slack build of YouTube-DL, and then you just copy the URL, put it into the command line, youtube-dl, then paste in the URL, and it'll fetch the video, and then you can just open it up in, like, VLC or whatever media player you use.
Or you could just use JDownloader.
Yeah, okay, I have to admit, like, this is kind of bad that they're coming up with hacks around this, but for the longest time, I could get out of following YouTube links by just saying, oh, I don't have Flash installed, but now it's like, that's no longer a valid, it's no longer a valid excuse, unfortunately.
I actually was, like, one of the first people in the HTML5 beta.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I did sign up for that, or, you know, put myself on that as well, so that does get me around it a lot, too.
One thing I've been doing is, on my browser, I've been setting it to disable cookies by default, and I've just been only allowing the websites to use the cookies that I choose, which makes it a little hard when I have to add the thing explicitly, but at least I don't have to worry about anything going wrong. But so far, YouTube works pretty well.
I usually just tell people that I'm Amish, and then they usually leave me alone.
That's what I'm going to switch to.
And they're like, you have 2 degrees in computer science. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Let's go make butter.
What's a computer science?
That's like a cat, right?
Did you hear about the Amish terrorists, the faction that went around cutting off men's beards?
No, I hope this is not a lead into a joke, because it sounds really interesting.
No, it's no. True. He's right.
It's being prosecuted as a hate crime, actually.
I heard about the Hindu guy that got pushed in front of a train. That's the worst.
That's horrific.
Saw this video of this old guy pushing this woman onto a train tracks, and the boyfriend beat him up.
Well, that accelerated quickly. Not escalated.
So, did we get here just because the Amish can use trains? How did we get off the one story and onto the other?
Can the Amish use trains? I guess if they're coal.
Well, they don't own the trains, so I guess they could. I think
They can use the trains for transportation, they just can't use it as, like, a way of life. Unless it's their job, I guess.
Huh. I think the thing about the technology is that they can't own anything more than any other buddy in the community, so that's why everything's down to that base minimum.
So everyone should just get Android phones, then, is what you're saying.
It gets complicated because there's no one group called the Amish. There's, you know, they're splintered into a bunch of different groups that have different rules.
Sounds like they would fit into the Linux community quite well, then.
It does.
They've got the beards and everything.
Oh man, RMS may actually be Amish. That would make so much sense.
I hope not.
Nah, he's an atheist.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true. That breaks it.
He's also the most religious man I've ever seen.
Zealot, perhaps.
What do you define as religion? It all comes down to what you define religion to be.
Well, would it be appropriate at this point to say that the best interview I've ever heard was done by Pokey, what was that, 2 months ago, Pokey, that ran on HPR?
No, it would not be appropriate to say that now.
Sure it would.
Wait, that was the RMS one that I heard? That was you?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, that was
awesome.
Oh,
that was awesome. That was a great interview. That's actually probably my favorite interview with them that I've ever heard.
It was actually, I'd have to say it was everybody, because very few of those questions were my own. Most of them came from IRC and from, like, you know, just my HPR pals who I just asked, do you have anything you'd like me to ask them? And people gave me questions to ask.
It was the way you presented them, though.
I've seen somewhere that there's a definition between a religion and a cult, where it basically defines the difference as being how many churches you have, i.e. more than one, and how many people you've killed, i.e. more than one.
Do you know what the difference between a cult and a religion is? A cult is religion, or a religion is cult plus time.
Religion's what I believe in, a cult is what you believe in.
Exactly.
Alistair belongs to a cult.
I've always heard that a cult was a religion that was, like, harmful to you, like, measurably harmful.
Aren't there a lot of
You could say that about
though?
A lot of religions.
Yeah.
There was that woman that was denied an abortion, and then she had the fetus die in her, and then she ended up dying of infection. That was based off of religious grounds. I think that was in Ireland.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's in Ireland. I didn't know Ireland had that backwards, like, old laws on abortion until I heard about that. That's really bizarre.
No, they don't. They don't have backwards laws about it. They have, she was denied it by the hospital. They were supposed to have granted her that.
Oh, okay. See, I had read the headline, and I guess the headline was misleading then.
They definitely linked it with Catholicism.
Yeah, I was going to say they were Catholics, I think. I don't think all people in Ireland are Catholics.
No, there is some legislation on the Irish statute that does actually make abortion illegal, and they've only in the last few weeks passed a law that it's okay to have an abortion if if it's life-threatening. So it is on the statute.
Yeah, I just
there was
it.
A referendum over 30 years ago in Ireland where it's called the X case, where the High Court passed a law saying that abortion would be allowed in the case where there was serious risk to the life of the mother. And there was a referendum that was enshrined in the Constitution. The thing is, the weak-minded politicians didn't put in the law in place, so despite having a referendum where they were required to put a law in place, they didn't do that because of the pro-life lobby. And speaking to all the doctors and everybody in Ireland, there is nobody who would interpret that, what happened there, as in any way being the correct course of action to have occurred. So there will be probably repercussions as a result of that anyway.
You've also got years and years of history to overcome in Ireland, and the fact that, you know, for a very long time, abortion was, you know, frowned upon. It was an absolute no-no. It was, you know, an underground activity that was carried out in, like, you know, sort of like back streets and, you know, women's parlours, because it was, you know, just, it didn't happen. It wasn't talked about.
No, I think it was. It's right now there is, I think, almost universal horror at what happened with that lady, that her life wasn't considered, well, whatever series of events that occurred to cause the loss of her life, there was actually absolute shock and horror from people about that, because we've had this abortion debate for over 30 years, and even before that there's been I think two, if not three, different referendums on it, and each time people are very clear about, yes, we don't want abortion, but yes, on the other hand, we do want to save the life of the mother. And that's a very difficult thing to put into law, because you can veer either side of it. And what happened in that hospital was, from what I understand, was they said, somebody just said, no, we're not allowed to do this, when in actual fact, another doctor in another hospital somewhere else would have had no problem, probably would have a problem, but would have carried out the procedure that was necessary in order to save the mother's life. I think that's even, not defending the Catholic Church, but I think some of the more sane hierarchy seem to be supporting that sort of line, although recently, from what I've seen them coming out with, you would question that as well. But there has been, since I was born, there's always been quite a lot of debate, and we've had a lot of discussion about it, where, you know, it's been convenient for, I think, the government in Ireland to just, you know, put girls in a boat and they head over to the NHS and they get the job done and they come back in, and it's been a very cowardly approach to a problem that needs to be solved.
Another thing is Uganda's Kill the Gays bill.
Oh yeah, I read that too.
That needs to be killed to death badly,
Greetings and salutations, everyone. No, this is not Chad Wallenberg. This is Claudio N. Just passing by to say Happy New Year to everybody. Hope everybody's doing well. It's not the New Year yet, but hope the holidays are all treating you well.
Hey, Happy Chad, New Year, how's it going?
Hey, Happy New Year, Claudio.
Happy New Year.
Hi, Claudio.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Claudio. And what do you mean it ain't the New Year yet? We've had, we're almost on our sixth one, 10 minutes from now.
Ah, that is true. Got to think globally. Nah, I figured somewhere it's already the first.
Six somewheres, actually.
It's not New Year's if you have to work through it like me.
Yeah, good point. Thankfully, I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, is Becky tracking where that is? Is it?
Yeah, we're coming up 10 minutes and it will be Indonesia, Thailand, the small region of China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, regions of Mongolia, Antarctica, and a small region of Australia.
Well, a very happy New Year to everyone that's in all those locations, and hope everybody else is prepping for some New Year fun.
Speaking of Chad, has anybody heard from him in like the last 6 months or a year? He doesn't even seem to come around anymore.
Yeah, he's at the Linux. He's at the conferences.
Just want to make sure Claudio hadn't done away with him and buried him in the Linux basement.
So that's what that smell was.
Oh,
I guess I should have taken care of that. A little Febreze will take care of it.
Pseudo Febreze.
By the way, Claudio, congratulations. I've been following you on Google Plus and the pictures of your lovely bride.
Thank you very much, Ahuka. Yes, I'm a very, very happy and very lucky man. I'll tell you that much.
Claudio. Yeah, right on. What's wrong with her eyes?
What do you mean, what's wrong with her eyes? Nothing's wrong with her eyes.
Really? She can see you just fine?
Yeah, she can. As you know, love is blind. She's blind.
Claudio walked
right
into that one.
Claudio, you should post ASCII art of your wedding pictures in IRC for those of us who don't Google Plus.
Duly noted, and I'll look into it.
I keep trying to convince my wife I'm as good looking as you, and she don't buy it.
Man, you really have some low expectations of yourself, then.
You can say that again. That's why I'm very rarely disappointed in me.
Man, you really have some low expectations of yourself, don't you?
Classic.
Thank you.
I don't know. I kind of figure the line can't go any lower, so I'm glad to be down there.
Well, I don't think you can get any farther than the floor, Soundy, given that one episode of Dev Random.
That was like 10 feet under. You know, that's where I figured.
That was awesome. I was rolling on the floor. No, not literally like some others, but yeah.
Well, I've been married for 33 years. I just hope that you're as happy as I am in 33 years.
I do too. Thanks, Ahuka.
By the way, Ken, my wife and I have made a decision. We're going to visit Ireland. It's probably gonna take us a year or two to save up the money.
Cool. If you need some tips of where to go, give me a shout.
I will be consulting you, sir.
Avoiding hospitals in Galway.
Get all of your abortions
beforehand. I hope hospitals
aren't
part of the trip.
Do not let them convince you to kiss the Blarney Stone.
Oh, yeah. Please kiss the Blarney Stone and post pictures.
Especially in ASCII for the people on RC.
You don't want to know what the locals do to that thing when there's no tourists around.
Of course, now that you said that, of course we do.
Just make sure you disinfect it first.
Not to mention, of course, the long queues just to kiss a stone.
No one wants sloppy Blarney Stone seconds.
Well, I think the music is going to be a big thing for me. We have a Kaylee here around the end of the year that I went to on Saturday night and just had a great time.
Ahuka, will you be going to Southern Ireland or to Northern Ireland?
Don't
there
know
is
yet.
Only one Ireland.
Shut up, Ken.
Yeah, I haven't. We just made the decision that we were going to do it, and I think my brother and his wife may join us as well.
Southern Ireland is beautiful, especially the Waterford and Tramore area.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how we're going to do it. If we're going to try and get like a package tour or roll our own or whatever. There's a lot of planning and discussion to happen. But for both of us, it's kind of a bucket list thing that. You know,
it'd be a lot cheaper to go do a to do it yourself, and there are a really, really good deals now with hotels because half of the hotels in the country are owned by the National Asset Management Institute, and they have no interest in making a profit at all. Just keep the things open so that they can sell them later. So you can pick up the phone and ring. Right, I got this deal somewhere there. I want this sort of deal. I want free Wi-Fi. I want free parking. I want blah. I want breakfast. I want dinner. I want the whole nine yards.
Cool.
But it's a bit more work, obviously. But
and you tell them you want it for less than 30 shillings. These shillings, right, Ken?
I think they use euros.
Farthings?
Euros for what they're worth now.
I thought they paid with potatoes.
Right, that's it. You're fucking banned.
That's it, yeah, you're out.
That's a little bit racist there, my fella.
They might be worth more than dollars at this point. All right,
are we everyone all now racist, father?
His big willy father.
All right, everyone, I'm going to bow out. I wish you all a very happy new year if you haven't already rung it. And I hope the holidays were really good to everybody. I'm going to start getting the kids ready and all of us here ready for some festivities later. So Claudio, have a great one.
Before you go, one thing. Last year you said that you didn't want to take over Linux Basement. I think it's time now that you did.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it, trust me. I just got to find the time. Time is very limited now. I've got other priorities, as I'm sure you're all aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, thanks for stopping in. And say hello to the kids for me. I saw one of them on the Minecraft server the other day, but they didn't stay long.
Yeah, they've been Minecrafting this whole Christmas break, so it's been 2 weeks, and since I work for the school system, so I'm off these 2 weeks as well, so I'm definitely enjoying the time off. And yeah, and lots of Minecrafting around here, you know, whether I like it or not, it seems.
Yeah, of course. So you know thing, what, though? It beats the heck out of texting.
I heard they're porting Minecraft to the Raspberry Pi. That's another use for it.
Yeah, they are. They're porting it to that, and I'm dying to get one of those.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Boba Bex. Happy New Year to everybody. Enjoy. And Hacker Public Radio, number one. Love it.
Thanks a lot, man. Great to see you, hear from you.
Same here, guys. Take care. Happy New Year.
Bye, Claudio. And with that, we're about to roll over to our next New Year's time zone.
Go on then, Sam Tracy, you do it this time.
I don't have them all written down, so I don't have a thing here with a list of them. So
Happy
you get
New
to do
Year
that.
Then to Indonesia, Thailand, small region of China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, regions of Mongolia, regions of Antarctica, and a small region of Australia. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right, now I'm leaving. Bye-bye.
I'm not doing the next one in an hour's time. I can't half an hour's time. I can't pronounce them.
Later. Yeah, well, if you just post them, someone will do them. Don't post them now. It'll scroll by.
It's Myanmar and the Cocoa Islands.
I haven't brought this, had a chance to bring this up, but I've mentioned on the mailing list before that we're sort of underrepresented in those areas of the world. We've been saying Happy New Year's to the last 3 hours. So I'd like to invite anybody in those areas who's listening now or listening on the stream or later, if you're hearing this as the podcast, you know, we'd really like to meet some people from that area of the world and include them in our discussions, because we all too seldom hear from that part of the world, and it'll happen again once we move past the west coast of the United States and out there into the Pacific Ocean. Except for Hawaii, we don't really talk to anybody out that direction. So please, don't feel like language is any sort of barrier. We'd just like to make some connections out there.
Well said. Okay, guys, Becky and I are just going to pop out and get some dinner and stuff, so we'll probably be back later. Have fun.
Can I go with you, Phil? I'm super hungry.
Chinese is.
Hello, George. How you doing, mate?
Hey, what's up, mate? I don't know. Just figured I'd come in here. I'm also in the Hangout and rebroadcasting all this in the Hangout as well.
Cool. I saw it posted that you were rebroadcasting. That's cool.
Hi, George. How are you doing that, by the way?
Well, I'm just basically, I don't know. I have no clue. I just basically have them both going at the same time, and some people are listening to it via the Hangout, and I'm trying to coax people to come in, but, you know, I think some of them are scared. In fact, one of them's looking at me sweating all through his forehead right now.
Is that George Dosher?
Of course it is.
Oh, sorry, George. Sorry. I was, I didn't connect you with my... Hello. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Alistair. You probably didn't get when I was talking about you joined a cult earlier. You know what cult I mean.
Ah, I do now. I have mentioned the wonderful people at Tech and Coffee, but I'll mention them again because I have enjoyed joining that community. It's a good bunch of people over there.
Well, thanks. Anybody's welcome to come over and sample some of the Kool-Aid. I'm only kidding. It's a joke.
Cool. Well, we appreciate you joining us on HPR for sure.
Thank you.
Are you sticking around, George?
I'm gonna be in here for a bit. I'm probably gonna leave this going. About 45 minutes or so, I'm gonna take a quick lunch and head out and do something. But I'm actually working today, and I'm possibly working tomorrow from like 7 to 2 or something.
All right. Well, if you're about later off, I'll catch up, have a chat.
Sweet. It's cool. Well, guys, you have a great meal. Think about me when I'm not having Chinese and probably having something out of the microwave.
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
Okay, folks, let's take this opportunity to stop again. And I think we're more than 6 hours in, so this will be the end of the first Hacker Public Radio.
So you're on the third.
Yeah, well, how are we going to do this? Because there's going to be more than 26 hours of shows. Hello, everybody. You're listening to the next episode of Hacker Public Radio. And yeah, there's going to be, 24 hours. We've done 6 hours, 7 hours now. So if we're going to squash them into 1 week, or do we have them go over 2 weeks? Anyone?
Might as well just do 2 weeks.
Could you set it up so that you script it to cut out silence and dead spots and condense it down a bit?
Yeah, I'll do that all right, but that's not going to take massive amounts of time out. Looks like the MP3 streams are down, folks. Just give us 1 second.
Yeah, that computer's not even logged in right now. Looks like Kevin's working on it.
Okay, the aux streams are available for our listeners who can't hear us.
Yep, and if you need MP3, the newradio.net is also up, though it's not in the automatic rotation. That might have been that 6 hour timeout we were talking about.
Yeah, it could be, actually.
Has anybody's mumble client been disconnected and reconnected?
Not mine.
Not here. But then again, if we're active, I don't think it will disconnect and reconnect. I think it was only a timeout if you're not active.
Mine did about 45 minutes in. It disconnected and reconnected one time, and it stopped my recording for a while, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, mine did that about an hour ago, and I went to reconnect, and it connected itself, and I was like, ooh, lucky.
Yeah, mine reconnected automatically, too, before I even had a chance to do it manually. But I didn't realize it had stopped the recording and that it didn't automatically restart.
Oh, Pokey, what are we going to do with you?
Oh, exile?
No, that would be too good.
Do that, we won't have anybody to edit this mess.
Oh, Ken volunteered this year. I'm good.
Ha 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 ha.
Ken loves editing, you know that.
I love editing, yeah. Loaded in Audacity. Chop the first bit off, chop the last bit off, do remove silence, slap on the intro and outro, and we're done.
There you go. See, that was easy.
And looks like the MP3 stream's on its way back.
Okay, don't forget to hit record again, Ken.
I've been recording all along.
Oh, are you doing it from a different machine? You know, I discovered recently that that's kind of a dangerous way to do it, recording from a second machine and not recording from your primary, because if anything happens to that network stream, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah, well, my primary one, the Pulse Audio, just crashed for the first time ever. I had to reboot my machine, a few minutes ago.
Nice.
The MP3 streams are back verified. Welcome back to all our listeners and MP3 land, freedom-hating people you are. Although Dot said don't move to the aux stream because it's currently going to be switched from one server to another.
Sure, insult everybody, then give them a lollipop.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Did it? What is Door ZT? Did anybody figure that out?
His what now?
What is Door ZT? Did anybody find that out?
Oh, yeah, that's his machine that's streaming out to the newradio.net. I'm on that one now, actually.
Okay.
Okay, the UGG streaming server thing seems to be working a little better, but for some reason, it's still not picking up the Bugcast Icecast server. Amazing. Kevin, are you around? Kevin Wisher? He's in the chat, hold on. Very soon, folks, I'm going to be going off to let off some fireworks with my children, so if you need me...
What, yeah, with your children strapped to them?
Sometimes I feel like that, but as a good parent, good parenting sometimes is not doing the things that comes into your head.
Right, as a good parent, he doesn't strap them to the fireworks, he only lets them light them.
This is why I own chihuahuas, not children.
You can strap the chihuahuas to the bottle rockets and they'll actually take off, unlike children?
No, I hadn't had that idea, but now you've said it.
Well, if you get the big ones, not like the tiny little thin bottle rockets, I think you could probably get a chihuahua to get some air.
Well, there's a thought. Whee!
It's like a variant of the weather balloons in the lawn chair.
Oh, I love the Darwin Awards. Are they still going?
I hope so.
I guess there's still stupid people, isn't there?
As long as there's an America, I have hope for the Darwin Awards.
I didn't want to say it.
Sorry, that is very racist.
I'm an American.
Even so.
Wait, America's not a race.
It's true.
This is true.
It might it's be a good jingoist. Job
it's not. Yeah, it is until it's not until somebody attacks you and then all of a sudden you are.
It's a good job it's not a race because they'd be too fat to get anywhere quickly.
Oh.
Ouch.
Here is I, trying to bring up the tone of the conversation.
It says me at 21 stone, by the way.
I'm frankly offended those comments were made in a fake American accent.
Well, I have to say, they sneak sugar into practically any of the packaged foods that you get in America.
That's not sugar. That's corn. That's high fructose corn starch, not sugar.
The sugar-like substance.
As desperately as they want to call it sugar, so that they don't have to label it as such, you know, as high fructose corn syrup on the package, it is not sugar, and your body cannot handle it the way it can handle sugar.
It's not
the
good.
Grain farmer,
all the same.
I'm the rare underweight American at 12 stone.
I don't know what the heck a stone is.
It's 14 pounds.
Hey, Ken.
Yep.
The Z HPR music one that you've got recording there is still keyed up. And if you leave it keyed up, like, forever, it'll eventually have problems. It's not a bad idea to key it up every now and again so it doesn't get kicked. But if it's left like that, you get, like, lag errors.
Okay, it's off now. Thanks for the heads up.
You get the kind of thing that happens to John Dvorak and Adam Curry. If you guys ever listen to the No Agenda podcast, they use Mumble and they have problems all the time just because they leave it keyed up constantly and never you know, give it a chance to resync when they're not keyed up.
Well, speaking of fat Americans, I recently lost 3.5 stones.
Wow. Congrats. That's quite a lot.
I lost 1.5, 14 pounds. I lost about 1.5 stones recently.
Yeah, for those who didn't get my stone reference earlier, that makes me 294 pounds.
It's okay, I'm sure whatever stones you guys lose, I'll find.
I thought you guys were talking kidney stones for a second.
That would be even worse.
That's not fun at all.
Boom, boom.
That too will pass.
Oh, oh, ouch.
My father just recently passed one.
There are a lot of fat people here in America. Too many, because I'm in the Midwest.
Well, if you stop drinking a lot and you start eating vegetables a whole lot more, cut out sugar, and stop eating a lot of bread, you could lose quite a bit.
I do none of that except eat bread. I do eat bread.
But all those things are tasty.
That's pretty much all I did was stop eating bread, and I dropped 20 pounds in about a month, month and a half.
Did you say cut? Sorry, I've did you say cut out bread?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, good stuff.
Don't do that.
Oh, man, bread's like my favorite. I love bread, like especially those good, you know, bakery loaves. Wow. But yeah, I had to cut them out pretty much.
As Scott Pilgrim said, Bread makes you fat?
It depends what kind, but most kinds do, yeah. It's all the high gluten, and it's difficult to digest the way it's made.
Yeah, I've been doing the paleo diet, and that the bread is definitely not allowed.
Is that where red steak raw comes from?
No, I had that before I went on the diet.
That's but, weird and self-fulfilling then.
Yeah, the diet was just justification for the name he's always liked.
Yeah.
Well, I went vegan, I lost some weight, and then I like, no, I need the steak. So I went paleo and I lost the rest.
Just one important point here, guys, on a health-related issue, and I can tell you this from personal and family experience. If you change your diet and take bread out and that improves things, you need to go and see a doctor and get a celiac disease test, because that will probably indicate a gluten intolerance, and it's a serious health issue. So if you're finding that cutting bread out improves your health in some way, that might indicate a serious problem which you need to pay more attention to.
Cool, good to know.
Bread didn't make me sick. It just made me, generally led to a higher weight.
Yeah, that's what I've been going through.
Yeah, it's one of these things that's, it's all to do with the way that gluten in the bread is actually digested. But if bread leads to either weight gain or weight loss, it can be an indicator to this disease, celiac disease, which if you find you have that, then there's a whole bunch of other things which you can cut out fairly easily from your diet, which will just improve your overall health just 1,000%. It really will.
What are the other things that you could cut out if you're in that ballpark? But just to say, it seems to me like it's what you're saying is mostly for people who are extreme cases of feeling benefit when they cut out bread. You know, most people probably could benefit from cutting down the high gluten bread with their digestion and weight gain, you know.
Well, it sort of creeps into quite a lot of foods, but the obvious ones are pastas, and also choosing just slightly different foodstuffs, like, for example, ketchups and things. Between the brands, some will have a lot higher gluten content than others, so just changing your brand of ketchup might have some effect. But left undiagnosed, it can creep up on you with time. Celiac disease gets worse over a period of time. If you catch it early in the progression of the disease, the outcomes are generally better.
Is it just created by the gluten? Because it's just worth noting that most old varieties of bread making materials were very low in gluten, so you can still consume bread, make it in a different way from whole grains and fermented, you know, sourdoughs, and using the old varieties, you know, rye and some old varieties of wheat and stuff like that. If you really can't manage without bread,
there are a lot of commercially available gluten-free breads which are very good. Even Domino's Pizza has recently started doing a gluten-free pizza base.
It's just not fermented, though, unfortunately.
One thing you can do is you can make a mezza. You basically take sausage meat or meat and put that as a base for the pizza instead of the bread.
I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of help you can get with it, but it's mostly just knowing that you have it and getting some good dietary pointers and just slight adjustments that you can make to your diet, which improves it a hell of a lot. The trouble comes is if you carry on with it for a long time, the villi in the intestines get worn down and they don't regenerate, and the longer that goes on, the progressively worse it gets.
Well, I'm already eating gluten free.
Did one of you say you were paleo? Does that involve low fat generally, or there different interpretations of paleo? Some have lots of fat and some mostly lean meat, or how's that?
Well, you know, I'm not going to intentionally eat a lot of fat. I just eat it with the meal, and I try to trim off some of the stuff if it's there. As far as oils are concerned, I stick to olive oil for most of the stuff. And I try to balance my meats with my veggies. So I'm not just going to eat a big thing of meat without having a decent amount of veggies. Like, I try to at least have as much or even more veggies as I do for meat for any given meal.
Maybe you misinterpreted me. I'm a big proponent of meat and fat, you know, no vegetable oils. We consume a lot of butter and fat and meat for breakfast, dinner, and lunch. I don't have any kind of obesity problems. But maybe you haven't heard of the Weston A. Price Foundation, because I mean, there's a lot of criticism over the paleo diet for their exclusion of fat, because it's actually very important to eat all the fat when you have meat. Otherwise, you can create problems. You can deplete your body from vitamin A, my wife just calls in my ear.
Well, I do eat the fat. It's just that I don't eat a lot of it.
I think that it's a myth, though. Only reason I mention it, you know, it's a kind of myth, and most people have believed the lies being told to us about fat being bad for us. But you can't really eat too much fat. It doesn't do you any harm, and in fact, quite the opposite. And there are many individual groups of people who mostly lived on fat, you know. It's a lie that you get fat from eating fat. And for all of you who like cream and butter and all of those lovely rich things, it doesn't make you fat at all, unfortunately.
Is that coming from the same theory as the Atkins diet came from?
No, I don't think so. If you look at look up the website westernaprice.com or .org, I just did a Hacker Public Radio episode about it, but it hasn't quite come out. I think in a few days it will. But he's basically a dentist, a U.S. dentist in the 1920s and 30s, who went around the world. He was a dentist, and he was trying to find out why people had bad teeth. And he found individual groups of people who were sticking to their authentic diets over hundreds or thousands of years. And first of all, noticed they had perfect teeth. You know, and was surprised but pleased, and then went on to study what they were eating, and they were all eating slightly different foods, but none of them were the Atkins diet, none of them were paleo, none of them were vegetarian, and basically the foundation has sort of built up on top of his work, and it's got a wonderful, amazing website with, so you could easily be very overwhelmed with all the content on there and the sort of deep research and work.
I do eat the bone marrow.
Oh, that's wonderful, that is. We just killed a bull that we've had for 2 years, and first of all, it's such a luxury to go and, you know, at your freezer, get as much beef or meat. But the thing we love most is the liver, all the internal organs. It had such a massive heart, and, you know, have plates and plates. Ooh. Full of heart, the tongue, you know, all the internal organs. You know, if you have problems with your eyes, just eat the eyes of the animal, you know.
I love heart. That's one of my favorite meats to cook up. Whenever I can get heart, I get that. I like that because I like the consistency of it. I like and it's usually also cheaper. And a lot of people overlook it. They say, "Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting." Well, it's also delicious.
Do you enjoy testicles? Testicles, you know, go for the testicles. They're all it's funny because the expensive parts, which are the lean steaks, they're the things which aren't good for you. You know, they would be good if you were consuming it with the fat and, you know, all the Louis, I think that's what it's called in English, yeah. All the fat around the internal organs, if you feed the cow right, of course. But all the internal organs there can be so cheap because people have forgot that they're the most valuable, fortunately. So you can get them great and cheap.
I just bought like 2 pounds of chicken hearts for like $1.50.
That is wonderful.
It has to be said, there's a wonderful thing in French cuisine called a duck confit, which is ducks, various parts of duck, which are cooked and braised and then
preserved in just pure duck fat, which then solidifies and then recooked again. Oh,
I love duck. I just
yeah. Duck confit is something you should try proper, you know, from a French recipe. Absolutely unbelievable flavor.
Or better better still, just get your own goose and cook the whole thing. You know, it's lovely. But my wife introduced me to dipping bread into all the fat around after you've baked the goose. That's lovely.
I recently made a leg of lamb, and then after that was all done, I boiled the bones and made a nice stew out of that, and that came out really good.
I'll tell you what is absolutely superb, a very underrated piece of meat, is lamb shoulder. But you have to do it very, very slowly. If you get a whole shoulder, you want to be talking about a minimum of 4 hours cooking. But if you want, that is the most wonderful piece of meat going. Really, really tasty. Very fatty as well.
Have you guys heard about grass-fed as opposed to grain-fed and the differences in quality, you know, organic and but specifically grass-fed?
According to the paleo diet, they recommend grass-fed whenever possible. I find it kind of difficult where I am to get a hold of that unless you want to spend a whole lot more. But the lamb was grass-fed, and that tasted a whole lot better.
Yeah, we're lucky in the UK. In the UK, most beef and lamb is grass-fed as standard. We're very lucky in that respect.
Are you really sure about that? Because I'm a big listener of Farming Today, and so I hear all the journalists going and visiting farmers, and that isn't the impression I get from the way they're keeping their animals, you know?
Oh, sorry. That might be a bit more regional to where I am. I live in the southwest, and my brother-in-law is a beef farmer. I tend to get less supermarket stuff anyway. I guess the stuff that you would regularly get in the supermarkets would probably be more grain-fed and more intensive farmed. But here in the southwest, it's very easy to pick up. We have more proper old-school butchers who are outside of the supermarkets, and they have a more direct link with the farm industry anyway. So I guess I'm talking from that perspective, really.
So you know what your brother feeds the cows specifically yourself, that during winter the rations don't include the cow cakes that they make for them?
No.
And silage?
No, he makes quite a good living. Aside from the beef, any of his excess silage is obviously very valuable. And when the actual meat side of the business doesn't do well, he makes that up with any excess silage he can sell off. So, yeah, it's the real deal grass.
That's nice to hear, because I haven't heard many other people just feeding 100% hay or silage or grazing.
Same way as rabbits?
Over in the U.S., it's FDA standard that all beef has to be grain-fed for 2 weeks before it's slaughtered to flush out anything in the system. It's a mixture of just kind of like fattening up, but it's just like corn and grain.
I wonder exactly what they're trying to flush out, you know?
Well, all I the saw good that taste. They were corn prices went up and they were feeding them candy.
Well, that's the reason I asked about what they feed in the UK, because I heard an episode on Farming Today where they were talking about all the out of date breakfast cereals from supermarkets, chocolates, pasta. They were all being sold in mass to this one company in the UK that was reprocessing it into cow food, you know? And that was like, my God, you're joking, aren't you?
Well, this is the trouble. Up on the soapbox time, this is the trouble with the supermarket. It takes over whole rafts and dictates to the whole supply chain exactly what happens within the whole field, and That's the trouble. Just encapsulated that if you put one part of the chain in control of the whole rest of the chain, then you get these practices become popular.
I'm not sure you can blame completely the supermarkets, because it's all the consumers are complicit in it, you know, because we all want not to think about it too much, but get the cheapest price, you know, and the education isn't there to actually inform people what's going on. You know, it's a shock for me sometimes. I listen to the Farming Today and I'm surprised what practices are being carried out, you know.
To a degree, I agree with you to a certain point, but when supermarkets deliberately put themselves in a monopoly position and eradicate all the possible routes of competition, then you can't blame the consumer when the consumer has no other choice, which in many cases they don't.
It's like the Walmart problem, it sounds like.
And it's happened slowly over the years. So, I mean, in the beginning, the consumers maybe didn't realize the big power the supermarkets would have eventually, you know. So, oh, it's a bit cheaper over this little supermarket, let's go over there. But, of course, that gave power to the supermarkets for them to get bigger over time, and hence the problem. So it's a slow-growing cancer, you know.
I got a question I want to ask you, Farmer Guys, just before we get too far off. And I know I think somebody else had just asked about rabbits, but I want to know from you, Farm Guys, what's the deal with eggs? Because I know if I buy grocery store eggs and, you know, and buy like fresh chicken eggs and crack them open, they are not nearly the same. They don't taste the same. They don't look the same. They cook about the same. But how come grocery store eggs are so yellow and runny, and fresh eggs are orange, almost red? And
I've got to come in here. As somebody who gets all my eggs from five hens in the backyard, I can tell you exactly why that is, and it is diet.
Can I jump in and say as well, as a man who has 20 chickens in his shed sleeping, I would absolutely agree with you, it's diet. And not to give them grains unless you really have to in the winter if it's only snow. Let them have as much free forage of eating bugs. It's amazing how excited they get to eat worms and little bugs and stuff like that. And then you get orange eggs.
Yeah, what you get with commercially farmed chickens is they only get fed things called layers pellets, which are just the worst end of the food chain, compacted into these dry pellets with very little nutritional value to the chicken. Whereas a chicken is the most incredibly omnivorous animal you've ever seen in your entire life. They will eat almost anything, and they're designed to do that. It's incredible how much your communal garden chicken will lay waste to, given the opportunity. They are unbelievably destructive but wonderful creatures.
I saw a good setup where they had a big field, and they had like a cage enclosure for the chickens, and the chickens just ate whatever was in the thing, and each day they would move it one cage place forward, rotating the whole field, so they didn't have to worry about cleaning up after them. And each day they had a new supply of grass and whatever bugs were in that area.
The chicken tractors.
Brother Mouse did an episode on this backyard chickening, probably 2010. It was one of my favorites.
It's a really good method, but it doesn't quite give the chickens the free range to really find the bugs they want, you know, because they're in a limited space. And the bugs can hop out, or you know, they need to hunt around and dig in different places. So it's better than the commercial. But if you have the chance to have them free range, you know, you can easily train them to come back to the same place every day. If you have a little orchard for them to be under, it is better still.
Well, the thing by me, I have to worry about coyotes and raccoons and some other animals that might try to kill them off.
Yeah, up here we got foxes, bears, raccoons, coyotes, pretty much the gauntlet, stray dogs.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. It's in ideal conditions, but those chicken tractors are a really nice idea still if that's what you're limited by.
And don't be fooled. A chicken is a feistier creature than you'd imagine. Once they get to a healthy weight, they can defend themselves to a degree. They're not totally vulnerable.
One thing I'm hoping for is the Chickenosaurus. Did you ever hear about that project?
No, what's that?
What's that?
Well, the birds evolved from the dinosaurs, and they still have some of the DNA. It's just a lot of those genes are switched off. So the project is trying to find the genes that code for teeth and arms with claws and a long tail, and to re-enable it in the chicken. So you basically have a dinosaur-looking chicken.
Thanks for that, Dr. Frankenstein. Don't know whether I like that idea.
Me neither. I think it's not such a good idea, actually, but...
Didn't we already talk about Jurassic Park?
So I'm reading on the Weston A. Price Foundation website, Dude Man, and he, on their dietary guidelines, it says things like microwave radiation is to be avoided and fluoride in drinking water is a bad thing. And a lot of stuff that generally is... It looks pretty pseudoscientific. Do you know anything about this?
I'm not sure that that's pseudoscientific. There's a lot of evidence to show what actually happens to food, for example, in a microwave. That is only one. There's a lot of references. My wife is translating one of the books into the Czech language, and it's amazing the things she comes across and the amount of study. I definitely wouldn't dismiss it. And the biggest factor which has impressed us is the difference is in people's shape and development of their teeth. Like, ask any other dietitian why children have to wear braces when they're younger, and let them explain why and how they can avoid it without any surgery or intervention, and just by what they eat. And I don't know any other nutritional expert that will tell you exactly how it occurs and all the other changes in physical shape of growth of children and maintenance of health of adults, So look a little bit further still.
Another thing it kind of brings it down is it's harder for the average American to eat some of these from the farm healthily fed animal foods. Is the governmental policy sort of favors the big factory farm over the smaller free-range family farmer?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of the problem and part of what they're trying to educate the public on. I mean, they're not saying... I mean, we live really pretty perfect lives by what we eat because we produce it all ourselves. And it's taken us 10 years to get the practice to be able to do that, But in the beginning, we were buying not perfect types of food, but everybody can focus on some of the more nutrient-dense food, even if it's not of perfect food origin, even if it's from commercial sources. And, it's a matter of prioritization and doing a little bit, cutting out the things which aren't so good and introducing gradually more of the things which are good and understanding it. But most of all, not falling for the state and the money-led propaganda, which is really, really abundant. And
so the recipe thing
for
when, I said.
When somebody mentioned earlier that, you can't always blame the supermarkets, personally speaking, I have absolutely no problem at all lumping a whole heap of blame onto the supermarkets, because... The trouble is nobody's tackled changing their ethic. Some people have had some success changing some of their practices, but it's whether we are actually encouraging them to improve their overall ethic, to move away from profit being the only good, to something a bit more valuable to society. I don't see how we do that. I don't quite know how we do that, but it doesn't seem that anyone's trying to change that fundamentally.
It seems to me grabbing the stick by the wrong end, to be honest, because they're a business at the end of the day, and it's also not really constructive trying to find someone to blame. It seems more constructive to think and to study properly what food is actually good for us, you know, and then how we can source it ourselves. Maybe you can get some stuff from the supermarket, but for individual people to actually, you know, vote with their feet and create change that way. After all, it was them who created change by giving the supermarkets power gradually and progressively over time, which got us into this situation, you know.
Well, but it actually goes back to the suppliers for the supermarkets, and probably the best way to change the suppliers' attitudes is to actually put pressures on the supermarkets to actually carry things that are actually appropriate for us, as opposed to saying, we're not going to support the supermarket and go to someplace else. That's just going to make them hurt more, and it's going to make them get cheaper, worse stuff, and it's going to hurt the overall population.
Well, we only have to look at the milk market. We only have to look at the milk market to see a classic example of how it works. I mean, I don't know how it is in the US, but currently in the UK, most milk-producing farmers are actually producing milk which is being sold on the shelf at a lower price than they can actually produce it for on the farm. And that's purely because milk and milk distribution has been placed into an almost exclusively monopoly position towards four companies. And the independent producers of milk have been wiped out by the big supermarkets. So I don't see how you can take responsibility away from the supermarkets for the market situation if there's nobody else to compete with them.
In the U.S., it's basically most people get the milk at the supermarket, and it's usually from big factory farmed milk places.
Just wanting to sort of summarize here, but not wanting to deliberately be controversial, but the milk in those supermarkets isn't really fit for drinking and actually causes so many problems and is a reason why milk currently today isn't healthy to drink. You know, there's a half truth there. If you just go to rawmilk.com, you'll learn the story. But, you know, basically the milk needs to be as it comes out of the cow, and the cow needs to be fed the right food. And the cow needs to be the right kind of food. We need high-fat milk, you know, and all of this is explained in very, very big detail in the Western A Price and rawmilk.com.
There needs currently to be some bacteria in the milk as well, because your gut flora depends on it.
Yeah, I mean, you need the bacteria which is supposed to be there, and you don't want it killed by pasteurization and homogenization. And then it, when it goes rotten and off, it stinks the high heaven. But you know, when it's raw and fresh, it only gets better when it goes sour, if you let it get sour and don't drink it quickly. You know, it's amazing, like chickens. It's an amazing thing, raw milk, and I find it difficult to imagine going back not having it, to be honest. We've been drinking it for 10 years, you know.
But does the milk actually need to be gargled first, like they do at White Power Milk?
I'm not sure what you're talking about, sorry.
It's a joke.
Oh, okay.
Back to chickens real quick. How much land do you need per chicken, would you say, for them to be free range?
Well, we have an area where they go, which is about one just around our farm buildings, which is half a hectare, which is one acre. But we don't even notice any impact for them, and that's about 20 chickens. So I would guess at least 1,000 square meters, maybe 2,000 square meters, and you might even not notice any impact. And I know it might be different in the US with more aggressive predators, but in Europe and the UK, if my understanding, as long as you've got some tree cover so the predator birds can't come down and get them, then you're pretty safe, I think, if you've got a fenced-in area to have them free range. That's at least been our experience.
There's a lot of tree cover.
Yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. They really are. I went out to the barn just yesterday, and I'd given up collecting eggs, and I heard one of them just cluck, and I thought, God, there's going to be one more egg. And I looked underneath her, and there was about 15 eggs that I'd missed over the winter, you know. So we were really happy to have some eggs again.
So how often do they make the eggs?
Well, it depends on the breed. You can get some breeds which you know, lay in very intensively almost all year round and one egg every day. But it's again, it's like It's a compromise between an old variety, which might be more sturdy and more healthy, but it might not lay so many eggs so regularly. And I would personally go for a larger quantity of older variety of chickens, you know, which haven't been so modified for sort of high production, but they tend to be hardier and more self-reliant and self-sufficient, you know.
How do you keep them in the winter? I mean, over in New England, it gets pretty cold sometimes. Do you have like heated enclosures, or what do you do?
Well, we're in Central Europe in Czech Republic, and we have pretty deep snow. It gets down to minus 20 or minus 30 on occasions. Owls just sleep inside a shed. As long as they've got a place out the wind, it doesn't matter necessarily if it's cold. You know, what you can do is make a small boxed enclosure, just open it in the morning for them, somewhere off the ground, out of the wind and the rain, just at night. And they're really pretty sturdy creatures, you know. As long, like all creatures nor humans, if you give them good food, then they'll have much less health-related problems. And if you don't demand too much from them, you know. But that's the problem with all the kind of industrial. And when you put any business element, then you start to think, well, how can I get just a few more eggs, a few more liters of milk, you know. And then the temptation to pump it up a little bit with grains and then a bit more grains. And then you can run into health-related issues. You know, which you might not connect with food directly, but they are, you know, like humans.
What do you feed them in the winter?
We give them scraps from our food. We boil potatoes for our pigs and give them whey from cheese making. We give them some grains, but we soak them in some warm water and, you know, let them start to ferment a little bit. We killed a bull recently, so they were eating all the meat scraps from. After we'd boiled all the bones and everything like that. Pretty much anything you have, you know. But try and make it rarid and, you know, minimize the grains if possible, because it's just full of gluten, you know. You're probably better boiling root vegetables or, you know, maybe turnips or potatoes or something like that instead of corn and grains. They seem to be the kind of the modernized poison for feeding in industrialized animals. And maybe even, you know, a worse culprit is the soya bean, you know, unfortunately, which humans are being persuaded to eat, but which is very poisonous.
I don't eat soy, and well, that's part of the paleo too, is cutting out like soy and legumes for the most part.
Yeah, there's a real... Sorry to interrupt you.
Continue.
No, there's a lot in common between paleo, I understand, and the Western A price, but I'm understanding the problem with paleo is that they exclude or don't emphasize that you should eat more and more and more fat, that it's a catalyst for many aspects.
It depends on the there's several different, you know, strains. Some people were saying, oh, eat a lot of fat, a lot of animal fats, and some people were saying lean meats. So I think it's very much up in the air. On whether you should have lean meats or very fatty meats.
Me and my wife have been studying it kind of for the last 10 years and so intrigued and interested. You know, at one point we were interested in macrobiotics or vegetarianism, but we could never quite find the depth of knowledge, the foundation to justify why. You know, for the macrobiotics, my wife was in Japan for 2 years. And what they said was a Japanese motivated diet just had no relation to what the natives in Japan that she met and heard of were eating. So, you know, that kind of put a nail in the coffin of that one. But
what were they eating?
Well, I mean, they were eating very much what the Western A price diet is, you know, pork fat, pork, fermented vegetables, broths. You know, when the vegetables were eaten, they were eaten in small quantities, but as kind of condiments, as a kind of real tomato sauce, you know, but fermented. All the vegetables will be fermented and like sauerkraut and pickles, but in much smaller quantities on the side of the plate, you know, but a bigger emphasis on organ meats and fats. Not to mention, of course, the fish and the eggs and everything like that.
Now, have you ever raised any rabbits?
We did try. We had some rabbits from a neighbor. I love Czech Republic because a lot of people still have animals. And it was our first animals we tried. But to be honest, the rabbit is a poor man's food. And the rich man's food was, you know, the rich person had a cow, but the poor person had goats or rabbits, you know, because it's not so fat. It survives more marginal areas. And here in Europe, at least, there's a problem with myxomatosis and other places with rabbits. And we couldn't get our rabbits to survive unless we either injected them or gave them a kind of food specially made for them, which had got some kind of medication in them. And we didn't want to do that. But the biggest problem is that the meat is too lean. And they're fluffy and cute.
I read a little thing once about rabbits and squirrels and how there's tons of them out there, but you can starve to death eating those.
I was thinking about doing deer hunting, getting some venison.
It's harder than it looks.
Have you got some land?
Pokey, it's only hard because you're using a gun. Use a truck. It's a lot easier.
I know. What I'd like to do is jump out the tree and strangle him.
Bait, man. Use bait.
Sometimes that's illegal.
That's a whole... Well, no, it's not strictly illegal. There are ways to do it legally.
It's illegal to hunt over bait, but you can bait out of season. Well, at least down south.
Yeah, up here you can bait, but you need a permit and landowner permission, and it gets into stuff that I wasn't ready to get into my first year hunting. You know, I mean, there's a big enough learning curve as it is to have to deal with bait. But to answer your question, dude, man, no, I don't have any land, just a yard.
Oh, I was only going to encourage people. You know, chickens are amazing because sometimes it's a bit wasteful to keep killing an animal, and you know, I'm not a vegetarian, but I don't like killing things, although we do. But chickens are great because they've got quite a long life, and they make so many eggs, and eggs are just, you know, wonder food. You know, they're fed on good food and what have you. So I think anyone can have. There was a guy earlier who said he had an apartment with some chickens, didn't he? And a very small garden outside. So anybody can keep them, I think.
They so have apartments that have them over here, but they're usually used for fighting.
So yeah. You keep your chickens years at a time. When I was growing up, we'd keep chickens through, you know, like the beginning of the year till summer-ish. And in fall, we'd slaughter the chickens, get more chickens, and then rinse, wash, and repeat.
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you're going to have them for meat or for eggs. I mean, I think a better system is to keep them for the longer run, because then you're not going to do so much killing, and you actually get more return from the eggs than for the lifetime of the chicken and for the input. And when you do kill a chicken because he's too old, the meat will be yellow, you know, and there'll be such wonderful fat in there because the chicken has had time to mature and age. Just like all the animals, you know, killing them too young, the meat and the fat and whatever you're going to make bone broth from hasn't sort of accumulated the wealth of nutrition that we're hoping to get from them, you know. So I would recommend against just going through that short-sighted cycle and rather going for the long haul.
Well, the reason we went with the short cycle, hang on, I got a cough. And the reason we do the short cycle is there's a chicken house that's up the road from my parents' place, and they get rid of their chickens every fall because they have to clean out and wipe everything out. And so we get free chickens that are already laying, and they're not even a year old yet, and we just use those.
Yeah, I understand. It's only that the quality of the... It's going to take you a while to get some good food into them and change their diet. You know, I'm not saying that wherever you get them from is terrible, but it's going to be commercial, and you know that the chicken's going to be laying different quality of eggs than you could get if you did it yourself. You know, it's not difficult if you just have a few old chickens. It's not difficult. The first, as long as you have a cock, the first 10 eggs you have, put them in a small incubator, and 30 days later you've got your own little chicks. You know, and easy to breed them yourself, and no trouble to keep them over the winter. They're very easy keepers.
Dude, man, can I ask how you got into doing this stuff, like living, you know, farm hippie lifestyle?
Yeah, you won't believe
you
it, but
can't.
It was.
He has
it
his
was
own
Linux.
Podcast on this.
It was Linux.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, because I was amazed by the freedom and the sort of attitude of openness and sharing with source code, you know. And because I just had free time at the job I was doing, and I didn't want to be doing proprietary stuff, and this was like a good 12 or 15 years ago, I couldn't find any kind of job to get into for open source. And I thought, I can't stay at this anymore. So the more I read about it on the internet, the more I realized I had to do something. And of course, the first year it was just a few chickens and a few rabbits and a goat or two. And it built up gradually, you know.
And you just researched it along the way?
Yeah, definitely. Research along the way. And me and my wife never thought that we'd have cows. But basically because of the Weston A. Price Foundation and our new awe and respect towards butter, I realized that there was no choice but to get the cows because we wanted butter. And the first time, you know, we were scared of big animals like a cow. So we got a donkey to begin with. And I was scared of him, to be honest. And I had some problems with him. But since then, we've got more cows. We've had bulls. We've got some horses now and everything, but it is a little bit, you know, one step at a time, but it's definitely in the realms of possibility for a useless computer programmer, because that's what I was and am still.
Cool. Sounds really cool.
But sorry, guys, to dominate this a little bit. Someone mentioned food, and it's a bit of a passion of mine.
Oh, no, it was the perfect time for me to get on. I'm starving now.
Well, and on this note, I think we have another New Year's passing here. Was it like Myanmar and some other countries?
The Nuber has left, and they were the ones with the... they had a map going that was showing them where it all was.
Yeah, they mentioned it before they left, and I don't remember what all countries other than Myanmar.
No, I don't remember either, and I didn't see a link.
It's timeanddate.com. I just couldn't find the thing that they were looking at.
Everybody frantically searches timeanddate.com.
I think I just found it. I see what she meant about not being able to pronounce any of them, though. Phnom Penh, maybe? Chongqing? Irkutsk? Possibly Singapore? Or am I too far behind now?
I don't know, but with that kind of mispronunciation, you, my friend, are a true American.
Yeah, thank you.
Are we still alive? Everything okay?
It's a strip of Russia and China. Definitely are in the new year.
Everything's going well, Ken.
Just panicking there. My 3G connection died. So what did I miss? Hopefully not an interesting conversation about food and cows.
As a matter of fact. Yeah, no, we weren't talking about food, Ken. We were talking about strapping kids to fireworks still.
Yeah, we just set off a few small ones. One of them actually fell down and came streaming straight towards the kids. And I said, right. Well, I saw it falling down and I said, right, come on, run back here. And they did, and it just landed where they were.
Show of hands, guys. Who's surprised? Anybody? Anybody?
Because showing your hands works so well in audio.
This is why you don't... Yeah. This is why you don't buy fireworks for your kids, Ken.
You make them yourself.
Don't have them. It's actually, when I came here, it's a very funny thing for me to have fireworks, because fireworks are banned in Ireland for obvious reasons. Fireworks
In the What's States, this? It's kind of like by a state-by-state basis, but normally what happens is you have someone, and you go on a family trip to another state, you buy it, and then you smuggle it back to the state that has the restrictions on it. So it's easy to get them. In the Northeast, you could always go to New Hampshire, or if you take a trip down south, you could always bring it back up. But yeah, that's more or less what happens.
You could always live in New Hampshire like some of us do.
That sounds good.
So when I was growing up, you wouldn't see fireworks at all, because, you know, if you were caught with fireworks, you were caught with explosive material and you were going down to the farm for a while. So when I came over here, I couldn't believe it. Like, the amount of fireworks that the neighbors fire off, it's absolutely incredible.
Oh, Ken, you would love some of the trailer parks we got here. I mean, it's every Friday night from July until the end of summer.
So true.
Where are you?
Who, me?
Yes.
I'm in New Hampshire. I'm in the southeastern corner of New Hampshire.
Over by Keene?
Yeah, a little south of that. I'm in Rochester, actually. Sorry, not south of that. To be east, to be quite a ways east of Keene. Keene's in the western corner.
Mistake.
What's that? Either you broke up or I did it. I didn't hear you.
So what do you think about those Free Staters?
I wish there'd be more of them and they'd get here quicker.
Are you one?
Well, not by choice, but yeah. I was already living here and thinking like that before that movement started.
I've been following that. I might try to move up there eventually.
You guys want to explain what that is? Cult?
No, it's a movement. Actually, you'd probably even be better at it than I would be because I don't pay much attention to them.
Boom, linked.
It's basically trying to get as many libertarians to move up to New Hampshire to influence the system and make the state more libertarian.
Oh, interesting. That's a cult I could get into, possibly.
And their logo is a sweet hedgehog.
Perfect.
Porcupine.
Oh, looks like a hedgehog, but yeah, I guess that is a porcupine.
Sorry for butting in, but what's a Freesteader?
That's what they were just talking about.
Libertarians that move up to New Hampshire to try to influence the system, maybe create more freedom in their life.
And the idea is, as I understand it, is that New Hampshire is a good place to start because our state constitution is quite a bit more, it's quite a bit freer than even the U.S. Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution was largely based upon the New Hampshire Constitution, and a lot of it was actually cut out to be more agreeable to some of the other states. But, I mean, you know, for instance, our state logo is Live Free or Die. And, you know, I frankly would hope people get here faster because we have more people, more liberals coming up from Massachusetts and coming over from Maine and even Vermont to some degree. But just our state has turned very liberal lately, and it's not going to end well.
Wait, what do you mean liberal? You mean like, what do you mean?
Democrats, basically.
Okay.
Where it you know, they come here, like especially from Massachusetts. Massachusetts is very, very Democrat, very liberal, where they have just like everything is a service. Everything is taken care of for them. And they pay tremendous amounts of taxes. And here in New Hampshire, you take care of stuff on your own, and we don't pay many taxes up here other than our property tax. And when these people move up from Massachusetts and they start demanding all these services, you know, our economy really can't handle the tax increase that all these services cost. And a lot of them, you know, the laws that they want to pass and stuff are just, they kind of take your freedom away, take away your liberties.
I mean, another thing, New Hampshire has no sales tax, so there is quite a bit of people that live right on the border and go into New Hampshire to go shopping.
Yeah, there's that. We have no sales tax and we have no income tax, and but our property taxes are really high compared to other places in the U.S. and surrounding states.
Everything has to be paid for.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's just a matter of, you know, do we pay for it collectively and leave things up to politicians to bargain for them, and you know, we know the kind of corruption that happens there, or do we, you know, try to take care of things, agree to do it on our own, you know what I mean? And it's just, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, but you know, it's nice to have some choice.
I will just point out that our New Year's marathon has now hit religion and politics.
Weather up next.
And we got to nutrition already, so.
Oh, and we even got some tech in there. When you have 20 hours to fill, you got to talk about all number of things, I guess.
See, that's the funny thing, too. You mentioned having to fill time, and that's the kind of the idea that I went into it with last year when we just did the 12-hour show. Like, how are we going to fill 12 hours? And man, cool people just show up like this and it fills itself. You don't even have to worry about it. It's so great.
Well, that's good. I, you know, the thing that I was real happy to be here this year, and this seems like as good a time as any, because you did the New Year's marathon last year, and I was listening to it on Hacker Public Radio because it came out as, I don't know, 8 episodes or something. And I thought, I really need to be a part of it. So it was as a result of last year's marathon that I started recording shows for Hacker Public Radio.
That's awesome. That was absolutely the goal. That was that, you know, anything else that came out of it was bonus, but that was the goal, was that it would get people excited.
Definitely got me excited. I've recorded quite a few programs by now.
Yeah, and they're good ones too. I'm trying to get my wife to listen to your office series. She's a teacher, so I think it'd be useful for her.
And it's just started, Pokey. I've got at least four more that are loaded up and in the pipeline, and I'm writing more stuff now. So, you know, this could be 20 or 30 episodes before I'm done.
I really enjoyed your podcast on where to find good ebooks and whatnot. That was really nice.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. That was good. Yeah. It all flows together for me.
Well, thank you. You know, one of the things that I come at that from, and I hope it was fairly obvious, this idea of market incentives. I was professionally an economist for a number of years, so I have a certain bias towards thinking that way. And, you know, I'd like to see I'd like to see more companies that are putting this stuff out because they see an economic benefit in doing it.
That came across pretty obviously now that I actually think about it in that context, that you were actually an economist, because it was definitely from that standpoint.
Looking forward to it, Ahuka. I'm hoping my small company can start listening to them, because nobody there knows Office.
It's a fantastic series, Ahuka. You should be applauded for it. As I said to you on an email privately, it should be required reading for every person in every company in the country. I was going to say country, but countries would be a better explanation.
Well, you know, maybe we should, at some point, we'll collect all the emails and publish them somewhere. But I was, the way I got into this was that I was a professor of economics at a fairly small college. And then I was asked to become the faculty development officer because I seemed to have a better handle on technology than anyone else on the faculty. And that led me to developing all of this training in... It was Microsoft Office that I started with, because that's what the college was using. And then when I got into LibreOffice, it was, well, this is all the same stuff, really. And so that's one of the things I keep emphasizing to people, is if you learn the basic concepts right, you can use any Office suite that you happen to like. So someone could listen to what I'm doing and get the basic ideas for Microsoft Office or WordPerfect Office and use all of that stuff.
Ahuka, are you going to do something, could take 3 or 4 episodes, to how to fix uneditable stuff that coworkers put out?
Oh, that's not even a whole episode. There's a recycle bin up in the upper left-hand corner of your desktop, and drag and drop is all it takes.
Or start from scratch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, by definition, if it's uneditable, then it can't be fixed, right?
Well, sometimes it's, yeah, I guess starting from scratch, everything's a long process if you have to fix what's already there.
So what do you mean by uneditable? Do you mean stuff that's so tragically written and poorly put together that it's a nightmare even to try and read it? Or are you talking about like PDFs that can't be opened in any other format?
No, I'm talking about, this is mostly outlining. We do a lot of outlining and procedures and stuff, and I don't know, people just put in number outlines to make it look good and call it good.
I don't think that's the best way to do outlining, frankly.
No, that's the, well, I consider it uneditable.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is I've been focusing on styles a lot right now, because it's such a key concept when you're working with this. And the trick that a lot of people don't get is that the way to outline is use heading styles. And then you can take what you're doing and you can bring it right into the presentation graphics program. It'll create all your slides for you just by reading it.
Yes. The type of documents I'm thinking of that have been produced over years, literally, where you're supporting some old product, we're manufacturing. And what happens is these people had no concept of styles.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. And yeah, I don't, other than trying to explain to people, no, this is really the way you need to do it. I'm not exactly sure how to deal with it. I started off by taking a look at how this stuff is done on the web. And we know W3C has talked about separating presentation from content. And I use that as a jumping off point to basically say, well, you should approach office productivity in much the same way, that presentation and content are two different things. And then get this idea of what is the functional meaning of each element.
Yes, that concept, I'm going to try and get it throughout the company if I can, but a lot of it's just lost cause.
Yeah, that's too bad, because it's a really great concept. Maybe at some point we'll throw so much computing power at everything that it'll overcome our sloppiness. But
yeah.
For the moment, I'd just as soon learn how to do it the right way.
Yeah, I'm talking a small company that doesn't even have an IT department. The IT department is the boss's son.
Yeah, been there, done that.
I've done training in small companies as well, where people, not all of the people, but the vast majority of people were very receptive to, going for a day's training on Word, and a lot of them got really into it and started correcting other people's documents then after the training. So I don't think, for a lot of people, I don't think it's necessarily intentional that they want to produce crappy documents. It's just they haven't seen another way, and it hasn't been explained to them the advantages of doing it correctly.
I had an interesting experience with that. At this college I was at, they had a program for people who needed to finish their bachelor's degree, and the idea was that they might have had a couple of years of college and then had to drop out. And now they're 40 years old and realizing they're never going to go anywhere in their career if they don't finish their degree. So we set up degree completion is what we called it, and it was a series of seminars that they could take over 18 months. And as part of this, you had to demonstrate a certain level of computer literacy. And you could do that just by taking a test. But if you didn't feel comfortable taking the test, I created a class. Well, the class mostly focused on office productivity. That was the biggest part of it. And everyone who was going to take the class would put it off until the very last moment because they thought it was going to be terrible. They didn't want to do it. And then they'd take my class, and at the end, they'd be yelling at me, "Why didn't anyone make us take this earlier when we could have used it?"
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not my fault you put it off until the end. I wasn't the one who made that decision.
Well, Hookah, I put in the chat on your latest episode my pet peeve. I have yet any of the companies I do consulting for sit down the secretary's computer and need to open up their Microsoft Word, and the Zoom level isn't at that default 50% of the screen wasted because there's gray space on either side of the document, and you're seeing the entire margins. Now, I guess that some of them probably do like that they can see further vertically in the document, but if you're going to do that, buy one of those rotating monitors. But it's absurd that they just sit down and, like you said, they don't configure it at all. They have no idea.
The interface for it is also kind of cripples the vertical space because, the ribbon takes up a lot of vertical space, and it's designed at a time when widescreens were becoming popular. So, that made absolutely no sense. That's one of the things that I liked about Caligra, is they put it on the side instead of putting it up on the top and using a big vertical bars.
Well, one of the things I like to do is I will use some of that space by having my styles window open all the time.
Well, if you want to conserve vertical space, the best I've found is to have a system that has global menus. I set it up in KDE. I put a panel on the side, like on Unity, and I put a menu button that opens up the file edit, you know, menu bar in a button just says menu that's right underneath the launching button. And then I set it to automatically put the windows into full screen mode, and when in full screen mode to not show the decorations. And I put the decorations into a window control panel that's hidden up at the top. So I, when fully maximized, there's no menu bar, no window decorations, and just all app. And it actually works out pretty well.
Interesting. I don't think I'd actually like that, but maybe I should give it a try.
When you started talking, I said, oh man, there's one of those global menu people.
It's a global menu plasmoid that I use. It's there's also more options in KDE. There's one, there's I think an app menu you could put in the actual window decoration, and then you could also put one in the panel. And or you could just have one in a panel that just says menu, and then it goes to file edit, you know. So there's definitely more options if you go the KDE route.
Well, it's pretty much by definition. If an option exists anywhere, it's in KDE.
That's very true.
The thing is, you need to have the I think the package installed for it. It's I think appmenu-qt or something like that. It comes on default, I think, on the Ubuntu based, like Kubuntu. I recently migrated to Slack, where I haven't compiled it yet, but I'm gonna go look to do that. Maybe I'll try to get my hands dirty and create a Slack build.
That'd be nice.
One of the things, Slack builds and global menus, Klaatu must be your
friend. I know, that's like, yeah, that's all I really needed to hear.
I agree with that KDE is quite customizable, but I also find it harder to customize, and Unity is okay as well, but I've been actually customizing GNOME Shell 3.4 in Madeira 2 quite recently with extensions, and I'm like sort of I'm quite amazed at what I ended up with, really, because it is quite customizable with extensions.
Well, one of the things that I think links all of this, if we take a look at whether it's KDE or Office Productivity Suites or whatever, they have a lot of capabilities. There's a lot of customizability, but you have to invest the time to learn how to do all of the stuff.
Well, they're trying to make some of the stuff easier. I know that they're making it so you could download the window manager scripts right off of the config dialog. Just like you would like a desktop theme. And they're trying to make it so it's easier to download some of these add-ons. So, but you have to learn that there are add-ons and how to get them, which is a big stumbling block for many people.
Yeah, I love KDE. That's been my desktop of choice for a long time. And I know that I don't know half of the things I could do with it. But I just haven't sat down and spent enough time to figure it out.
Has anybody tried Plasma Active?
You mean like literally on a tablet or just like the interface itself?
The interface or the tablet. Either one.
I've not tried it on a tablet. I did play around with just like that, I guess it's the Active interface, but you know that one where it's just kind of like a search bar in the middle of your screen and you can search for your applications and then they all launch full screen. I've messed around with that.
I think that's the netbook interface.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. That's what I've messed around with. Didn't love it, but no, I've not tried Active.
Yeah, Plasma Active is the KDE netbook interface. And I haven't tried it, but I've been reading on sites about it every now and again, and looks quite interesting, so I hope it kind of ends up on devices and so on in the future.
It definitely looks interesting. They're trying to go away from the file-based you know, system and go based on metadata tags and activity-based organization. So basically, whatever you have open, you could easily pin to your activity, and the activities are basically separated based on what you're actually doing. So you could easily create an activity which is has its own separate desktop, which can have applications associated with it, files associated with it, bookmarks associated with it, and be able to easily open them up once you go and switch to that activity. And each activity can also hold windows too. So it's almost like a more advanced a virtual desktop.
Anyone actually use activities?
No, I tried. I can't figure it out. I hate them.
I looked at it last time I actually played with KDE, and I just couldn't figure it out. It just was a clumsy interface.
The thing is, here's a trick. If you want to use activities, there's a couple things you might want to try.
Yeah, but it shouldn't have to be a trick. It should be, here's something that we have in our desktop. It's a key core feature of it.
Let's hear the trick first. Oh,
okay. Okay.
There's the activity bar. Plasmoid, and what you do is you put an extra panel on one corner of the screen that is like auto hide, and whenever you want to switch the activities, you just put your mouse down, and then the panel pops up, and you could easily switch between the activities. And another thing you can do is you could set the mouse action on the desktop to switch on a scroll or a button press, and you could quickly navigate that way too.
Well, okay, so I mean,
what's
great,
the difference between that and a virtual desktop?
Yeah, like how do you get your activity to, like, let's say I want a video editing activity and a music editing activity. How do I get those two activities to be distinct from one another? That's the trick. I don't know yet.
For activities, they actually, for the KDE apps, it saves the state. So when you press the activity management thing and you press stop, it saves the state of each of the activities. So if you had like a bunch of let's say you had Kate open with a bunch of config files you were working on, and you stop that activity while that window is open in that activity, it would save the state in the file of what you're doing there. So when you reopen that activity, it would pop up with Kate with that file that you're working on.
Okay, but say you have a shell or something open and you're processing something. You're saying that that's going to be suspended for the entire time, that it's not continuing to work in the background while I'm doing something?
There's two things. You have them opened, and then you could stop them. So all the open ones you could switch between, but you could also stop the activity, which would suspend the application. The suspend only really works for what I found, the KDE applications that have like some sort of session management. But the thing is that they have a new interface and a new paradigm they're trying to work with, which is called the Share Like Connect. And being able to associate files with activities, even on the desktop, so you could set the folder view to your activities, and basically whatever, and you could connect files to an activity. It's in its infancy. It's being worked out in Plasma Active, but once the Share Like Connect is open, it'll be easy to pin the application, I mean the files you're working on, to an activity and make it a whole lot more useful.
I just don't see this activity thing as being useful, because I just think it's too complex. It's not obvious to me.
Yeah, I think probably what it's suffering from is the same thing that Nepomuk and all that stuff is suffering from. They introduced it in a completely non-working state at 4.0, and it's just been there, and we're at 10 now. I'm on 4.8, but you know it's been this whole development time, and it still isn't working. And so we're just kind of staring at these options, and they're not even functional yet. So why are they there? I think.
Well, on Plasma Active, the thing is they have the activities like right in your face. It's right there, and it's easy and accessible to use them. And the desktop definitely did not have that. It wasn't apparent. It's like, here's like this extra thing. You don't have to use it, but it has a whole bunch of features that you could if you want to.
I don't even see it having features that I could use. I mean, I literally do. I want to make an activity for someone for like they want to sit down and they want to do their music stuff. So I want certain applications like QJack Control. I want that to launch. I want Linux Sampler to launch. I want certain things to happen. And I unless I'm just missing it, which is totally possible, but I haven't seen it online yet, like a how-to, I can't figure out how to get those things to be bound to an activity. I can write a shell script that will launch them all, and then a desktop file that they can double-click to trigger the shell script, but not I can't get it just to switch over to an activity and bang, there's your workflow.
Yeah, I think the thing that from what I've seen and heard about the KDE activities, it's like it sounds like it's an interesting concept, but it sounds like it's like flawed from the start. Like it doesn't actually do the things that an end user expects it to do, as far as being able to set up things like for a project type thing, have an activity for a specific project, and have it actually be persistent so you can actually use that as a method of navigation. And it doesn't sound like it works correctly in that respect.
Well, that's the thing. Right now, at least on the desktop, there's no easy UI to say, here, I'm working on this file. I want this to be on my activity. Open it up.
Hey, do you know you said no easy UI. Is it something that you can do in a config file or something? Do you know?
Well, you could kind of, I think in 4.9, you could right click on an application in like Dolphin and say associate this with a current activity or something like that.
Okay.
And you could set the folder view to use the activity folder.
Okay. So you're it's almost like on a mobile phone where you put applications on a certain screen, like on Android.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the Share Like Connect, once that hits the desktop, any applications that are designed for it, it'll basically gets the information on what file is currently open, and if you do share, it basically gives you things like upload this to Flickr or email this to a contact or that. A like would basically add metadata to Nepomuk, like add a tag, like this, add it 5 stars. And connect would associate that file with the current activity. So you have a quick, easy UI to basically do the kind of interact with the kind of KDE technologies and actually make them useful.
Interesting. I still think they shouldn't have advertised it until it was ready, but that's cool.
Yeah, but it's completely tied into KDE. So now an application like Kate or some application that wants to take advantage of any of these things is completely tied to the KDE desktop and can't be migrated to any other one.
I honestly can't see myself using this outside of KDE. I can't see myself using it at all. You know, this is something that I would be using for someone I set up a computer for and said, here's the environment I've constructed for you, and here's how to use it.
Well, this is mostly the whole paradigm is going to be hammered out in Plasma Active. That's basically the testing bed to basically get everything down, because they don't want to break the desktop again. And they'll slowly trickle things out. But one of the interesting things that you will be able to do is once you have the ability to associate files with an activity, it's currently in the works to be able to lock an activity, and it encrypts all those files on that activity. So you could actually use it to hide stuff and use a kind of workflow like that.
Well, what concerns me as well about it is the fact that none of this is file-based. It's completely gone away from the Unix, many of the Unix philosophies for a start. One small thing, do one small thing and do it well. Everything is file-based. This is now a metadata database-y, linked in through mine types, essentially a mess. And
yeah.
I think you could access activity stuff through, I think, a KIO, K-I-O. So you could open it up in Dolphin and most of the KDE apps. But I'm not sure about the non-KDE apps and the command line sort of things. I'm not sure if there is a bridge.
sounds to me like the activities is designed in a way to help you manage your applications and windows and files and stuff. But as a knock-on effect, you're instead of doing that manually now, you're managing your activities. So that seems a bit strange.
Yeah, the UI definitely isn't down yet, and they haven't really worked out the whole concept on the desktop yet. That's one thing that was lagged. They had the capabilities. It's just that they had no way. I mean, the user had no good way of doing it, which is the big problem. You have these things, but no one really could do anything with it. But it's just starting to really come around, and I'm saying the big thing would be when the ShareLike Connect lands on the desktop. That's what I think of it. Really push it forward.
I think there's still some people here need convincing.
And maybe I'm just missing it. Maybe I just need somebody for 5 minutes or a presentation just to get somebody's vision. But I think it's an awful lot of buy-in. It really goes completely back to a desktop philosophy that I have completely given up on. I welcome the idea of being able to run one application from one desktop and another application from another desktop, all intertwined with, you know, scripts running on the console.
Well, scripts are definitely a good thing. Basically, the whole idea behind activities is that at least initially, you have all these plasmoids and they can specialize your desktop to do different things, but they're limited in space. And you have multiple different things that you use your computer to do. So the idea is if you have another activity, you could use it to hold different things. Like you could set up a separate activity that uses the folder view to your projects folder, or you could set up an activity that basically, you know, manages things. You could set up an activity that has maybe a picture of a picture of your family while you're at work, and then when you go home you have something else. It basically the idea is to separate your different activities and to have a separate specialized desktop for whatever task you're doing.
Yeah, but do people really work like that? And if they do, why don't they just use a different window? Or better yet, log in as a different user? I mean, both of those things which are supported by the majority of desktop environments we have out there.
Yeah, I'm with Ken. I don't work like that. I tend to, you know, if I'm doing a job, I use the application I'm using for that job. And if I start doing something else, I open another application. I might put it on a virtual desktop. I might not. Yeah, you know, I don't think that clean vision of having different spaces or areas for different activities, such as, you know, video editing or photo editing, I don't think computing really works like that. Things tend to merge into one another, don't they?
The workspaces in the desktop environments. I mean, it's there. It's been there in GNOME 2. It's there in KDE. It's there. Well, it's there a bit differently in GNOME 3. XFCE has it, LXCE has it, and so on. But I never really use the workspaces. I just tend to just stick to the one workspace or window, if you like.
Yeah, that's fine. But they're there if you want to use them. What I'm saying is they are supported. Depending on whether I've got dual monitors or not, I'll use a workspace. You know, if I'm just on my laptop, I might throw the IRC window into the second. Into a second workspace, or if I've got dual, if I've got an attached monitor, I'll whack it onto the second monitor. But kind of the point being that I don't, as Phil says, I don't work like that. Even in work, I'm busy doing something, I'm writing some code, so I've got a code page up. Then all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, hey, we need you to check this spec or this interface. So you open up a few words or Word documents or PDFs or something. And then you're printing them off, and then you need to take a screenshot of something because you need to file a bug report. You know, and the next thing you're SSHing into a Linux box and comparing something on a Windows server.
And then 3 or 4 hours later, you find you've got about a gazillion windows open, and you start closing them all down to start again.
Yeah, but at that time you need them. And sometimes what I'll do in that case is if it is getting really cluttered, I'll feck all the Windows remote desktops to a virtual desktop. I'll move all, then I'll divide it by activity. But, you know, I can't automatically say, it just requires an awful lot of thought. Oh, Johnny, you've come in and now there's an urgent matter. Let me just hibernate this activity while I open up something else. Sorry for pulling the piss about it, but I genuinely don't work that way, and I've never seen anyone who does.
Yeah, no, well, I can't see it myself either.
Yeah, it is very small, and it's almost like a new paradigm of looking at it, and maybe it makes more sense on the mobile devices like the tablets. So I guess we're just going to have to see just what happens. But I'm looking forward to some of the newer developments and the newer AIs around that.
Yeah, I think I'm ragging on you because I'm really glad that you've come on and are explaining this stuff to me. And a lot of my frustration with it is they put in this foundation. They have a vision, which is grand. They put in all this foundation, which is grand, but they're loading up services that I believe I don't need running on my machine, like a MySQL database sorry, my brain is just fried. Tattoo?
I don't know. I was
list
just
all
thinking
these services MySQL. KDE runs.
Yeah,
MySQL that, Virtuoso.
The thing
Umux,
is,
Strigi.
Strigi is getting axed for 4.10.
Finally.
Nepomuk's getting their own internal indexer. So they're doing everything in-house, and it apparently indexes a whole lot quicker and uses less resources. And as far as on the horizon, when KDE ports to Qt 5, they're also moving over to Frameworks 5, which modularizes their frameworks and makes it a whole lot more attractive for an average Qt developer to bring in those libraries. And since they've been working on Plasma Active, they've been thinking a lot more about trimming down the fat per se. So you can fit KDE on lower resourced devices.
Yeah, but again, why? Yeah, again, like I said, all these services running that were going to allow developers to build on top of it, and the developers didn't rush in. And
well,
I like
the PIM. I finally fell in love with Akinati. It's running in the background. I can have it sync with my cloud accounts. I have it. I pulled down all my contacts off of Facebook. And I was able to liberate that and made it a whole lot easier to build a nice functional address book with nice pictures and rather complete. And, you know, it's finally getting to the point where it's really usable and it's gaining more and more features. And the contacts actually and your schedule can actually show up in your clock applet. When you click on the clock app, it opens up a calendar and it will show you all the things for the day. It's actually getting quite integrated and nice.
Okay, that's fine. That's lovely. But you know what? There is not one desktop out there. Not one desktop out there that addresses the real need that every business has and the reason that Microsoft is still winning on the desktop to this very day. Yeah? And that is integration, seamless integration with Microsoft Exchange. KMail doesn't do it. Thunderbird doesn't do it. And there's no reason now. Before it was like a psychological thing. We don't want to support an undocumented interface. Well, since the EU thing has come along, that's been no argument. So
I think there is something that you can set up Akinati for. Maybe some sort of groupware thing.
Yeah, it's an exchange replacement, not an exchange. Okay. Okay, this is just another by the way thing. And just allow me here as a HPR segment to go on a rant about this, because people are chasing fantastic desktops and interesting technologies and the latest thing in broadcasting across the network, and Bonjour lets everybody jump on that, and desktop search is going to be the next thing, let's jump on that, and interfaces everywhere, you know, unified interfaces, touchscreen interfaces, everybody jumps on the latest thing. But the one thing that will help people get Linux deployed on the desktop is a viable, seamless replacement to Microsoft Exchange. And actually, I have an answer for this at the end because I've been researching it quite a lot. And when I say seamless integration with Microsoft Exchange, if you look at any device that's been out there, Microsoft Windows Phone, the original version, took over from because it had seamless integration with Exchange. RIM took over from that because it had seamless integration with Exchange, Calendar, and Outlook. The iPhone took over from that because it has seamless integration with Microsoft Exchange. Android has taken over quite a lot from the engineering, at least, because of the seamless integration with Microsoft Exchange. So I would argue right here and right now, the reason we have won on many other things, Linux has won on many other areas, is simply because we do not have a good connector to Microsoft Exchange. And what I mean by that is if you go to your boss and you say, hey, boss, I want to run Linux, and they will go, he or she will go, yeah, fine, doesn't bother me, but you need to be able to do your work. And you can't look them in the eye and say, I can do my work, if you're not able to communicate with everybody. If you arrive 20 minutes for the meeting, then you're instantly told, oh, I cannot use this desktop of yours. You need to switch back to the corporate desktop because we need you to be here on time.
That's fair.
Evolution's got a plugin for Exchange.
Evolution is shite.
Yeah, I was just about to say, but it's shite.
And I will tell you why it's shite. Back 10 years ago, when it was, you know, that monkey, Mikhail de Casas, he had a Zimian. I bought the connector for Exchange from them because it was proprietary at the time. And when I purchased it, it didn't work because we had a self-signed cert. And ever since then, I've been using that into integration. It has simply not worked. The solution, of course, has been Davmail. Has anyone used that? Davmail is a application that it's a Java app that runs. And what it does is you start it up and you give it the connection to your Outlook web access server, and it uses the same protocol that Apple iPad uses, Microsoft Mail on the Apple iPad. And with that, it will allow you to connect via IMAP to your Microsoft Exchange server. It will also allow you to connect a Dav Mail server up. It will also allow you to connect. So I've got a POP, I've got IMAP, I've got SMTP, I've got HTTP CalDAV, and I've got a local LDAP port. However, this is my rant. Absolutely brilliant software. You should definitely support it. It's Davmail, and it is the URL is davmail.sourceforge.net. If you're not using it, you should. And I've been using it for. Bob, my friend Bob. No, actually, I have been using it, and it is really, really very nice.
So could you back up, Ken, and explain what Exchange is to some of us who don't know this sort of thing?
Right. Microsoft Exchange is a mail server, and it's a calendaring server, and it's also a company directory, so you can look up people's emails and that sort of thing. It's the backbone of every small business. They get a Microsoft server and it comes with this small business server thing. It's got Exchange and people connect their Outlook email client to it and they're able to schedule meetings with Bob, Tom and everybody, and they're able to schedule a meeting room and a projector or something, and it all works, and then it syncs with their phones and everything works fine. It is the backbone of business, and when I say backbone, it is literally companies just operate entirely on email and their Outlook and their Exchange.
Yeah, now, I got your back. It does that. Our company uses it. So, you know, and on a Linux desktop, my only option is to use, there's a thing called, Web Exchange Web or something that basically turns Exchange into a an email client, a web-based client. But it, in comparison to Outlook, it's got very limited features.
And I work for the government, and we definitely have no choice other than to use Microsoft Exchange. You know, open source technology is not even an option.
Absolutely. It's everywhere. And if you're talking to, I said it before, but if you're talking to managers and they really don't care, they could care less what you're running. They really could. And so long as it's secure, you know, because when you think about, you know, I've been thinking about this for a long time and how best to do a topic on it. And I suppose the best thing is a rant just here on the New Year's show. So anyway, you can't stop me. But when I think back to, like, Microsoft didn't always own the desktop. It was the fact that years before you had a thing called Lotus Mail, if anyone remembers that. And then that owned the desktop, and it was brutal because you had to take the thing. Sorry, it was CC Mail. It was called CC Mail, and you had to take the thing down every night to reclaim the database, or it would use up all the hard disks. And people, all the Unix guys, are thinking, "Yeah, but we have Mail sorted. We run Mail on the back end." But they haven't Exchange sorted, and none of the developers, it seems to me, have ever worked in an area where they've worked for small, shitty businesses that run these, not, well, criticizing people, yeah, but small companies who just want Tom to be able to talk, the managing director to be able to talk to the sales guy in the field. That's all they want to be able to do, and if it's able to do that, they could care less what it runs on.
Has anyone ever used Zimbra at all? How does this fit into this whole quandary?
It's a replacement for Exchange, but it's not a replacement for... Right, here's the thing. Here's how technology comes into a company, you know, because we've heard about people, why has Linux not succeeded on the desktop? Reason one. Anyone want to give me a reason they've heard, and I'll smack it back down to being no good connector to an Exchange.
Because there's no good connector to Exchange.
Excellent. Good man. Well,
actually, I'll give you a different take, though. At several of the companies I've worked at, they didn't use Exchange. They actually used Lotus Notes instead. Now, here was the worst part about this. There is actually a Lotus Notes client that will run under Linux. However, companies don't want to get it, even though it's pretty much free. They still will not approve it, which basically keeps us from using Linux on our PCs.
Well, don't get me started about Lotus Notes, but yes. But if you hear people saying hardware manufacturers won't ship Linux, that's absolute rollicks, because hardware manufacturers will ship anything that makes them, they don't care. They'll ship Linux happily because it's cheap. They don't have to pay anybody for it. But the fact is, people need to be able to buy it or it's no good for them. The fact remains that if you look at how technology gets into a small company or even a big company for that matter, it's not that the IT department sits down and makes a strategic decision to do that. That's how upgrades happen. That's how you go from Windows 95 to 2000, whatever. That's how upgrades happen. But that's not how technology is introduced to companies. It's introduced by the employees themselves. If you don't believe me, look at the iPad coming in. And before that, look at the BlackBerrys coming in. It was brought in by people had to set up at home. They got it for Christmas. It's really handy. It's really useful. I need it for my job. Da, 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 da. All of a sudden, iPads started appearing everywhere. Agreed or not? Has people seen that?
Agreed.
And does anyone want to argue with me that a business case was ever done by any IT department anywhere to get iPads in?
Ruji, please do push to talk.
So, sorry, I've annoyed everybody on my little rant there.
It's time for another time zone, isn't it?
In 2 minutes.
Crap, Ken talked about that for an hour?
Okay, let's stop our recordings for a second and restart them again, please.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.